Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting on, affiliates around New Zealand and whatnot. I'm still getting used to the new format where we're doing a three-hour interview with really great researchers and what have you, without any commercial breaks, and doing it all pre-recorded as well. I think is quite nice. It's very relaxing. And, anyway, getting on to our very special guest today, his name is Kevin Galilee. Welcome to the show, mate.
Thank you for having me, Vinny, for the second time, I might add. I appreciate the opportunity, and we have a lot to talk about, so I'm not daunted by the prospect of speaking for 3 hours.
Yeah, I didn't think you would be. So you have a number of things that we wanted to get into, discuss, and during the last interview we talked about various methods of global depopulation policy, and it was in fact quite an enlightening sort of like, wow, this guy's actually got an intricate knowledge of the extraordinary levels of scumbaggery in our society and how they actually came about, and from a policy level it seemed like, right? It occurs to me that this is how the depopulation agenda is really being done. All these decisions are being made at the policy level at 30,000 feet, and all the people that implement it down on the ground floor, they have no idea.
Very much so. This is why I thought it necessary in the first interview to present, you know, the historical perspective of this policy, which is the pivotal policy of the international order since the Second World War. So the last time we discussed its causes and its methods, we placed it in historical perspective. We exposed the immoral, unlawful, and the fact that all these methods are covert and not overt. We disclosed to the public the fact that it has been going on since 1945 and not, as it is commonly believed, to be just a new phenomenon. So it is a policy that is in its seventh decade. Today I want to talk about its consequences. We didn't have a chance to cover that during the last interview in November. I also want to show how this policy fits in the grand scheme of things, how it fits in with the plan for global peace and security that was embarked upon at the end of the Second World War and with the formation of the United Nations. And I want to show how that it, in fact, the depopulation policy is inseparable from globalization, and it is actually the underbelly of globalization, if you want to put it that way.
One and the same, like strands of DNA intertwining.
Yes, because the goals of attaining global peace and security, which goes by the name of globalization nowadays, cannot be accomplished without the depopulation policy. And I will sort of elucidate on that as we go along. But to start with, I'm going to go straight to the middle of my book, where I have presented or outlined a short list of what this policy has cost us in human life so far.
But before you do that, can you please just give the name of your book and where the listeners might be able to purchase a copy?
Yes. The name of the book is Killing Us Softly: Causes and Consequences of the Global Depopulation Policy. It is available online by simply Googling my name, Kevin Galilei, and Killing Us Softly. It is available in at least four or five different places. And it will be published, unless the censors interfere, it will be published by Progressive Press this year, in 2015. We shall see if that happens or not. In any case, I will always make my book available for free to those who cannot afford to buy it, for the simple reason that the subject is far too important to everyone's survival, and it should not be subject to whether one has the money or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, by all means, proceed.
Okay, so the short list I've split into three sections. One, the cost so far in human life. Two, what exactly has been averted by introducing and by carrying out this policy. And three, what will happen if this policy continues in this form with the current methodology. So I'm going to follow this list so we go through it quickly, and then we'll settle on the details of the direct, indirect, and unintended consequences. Now, for one thing, 2 billion birds have been covertly prevented by chemical, biological, and bacteriological means. The magnitude of this policy is unbelievable. Now, 2 billion birds covertly prevented. In addition to that, approximately 500 million birds have been overtly prevented through legislation and abortion. And these mainly in China. 400 million of these birds have been prevented in China through their one-child policy. More than 300 million genetic lines, primarily in the developed world and primarily in the West, have been permanently and irrevocably shut out of procreation. Japan, Europe, Russia, North America, Australia, New Zealand, in other words, all of the OECD countries, all of the developed countries, in all of these countries, the IQ, the intelligence quotient, has been downgraded by approximately 15 points across the population. Now, in individual cases, by far more. And in certain brackets or sections of low socioeconomic income, even more so. About 10 to 15% of the population has been covertly chemically sterilized, and has been rendered sexually confused through chemical sterilization. This is one of the side effects, if you want, of prolonged chemical sterilization or chemical fertility depressing agents such as fluoride and BPA. If someone has been exposed, if a genetic line has been exposed over multiple generations. Most importantly, about 20 to 25% of all children born in countries subject to covert chemical sterilization methods have been condemned to developmental disorders. One out of five Western women have been rendered infertile or childless by a combination of chemical and psychosocial methods of population control. Compare that to one out of 20 in China and only one out of 30 in India. And you get an idea of how huge this discrepancy is.
It's funny we should be talking about this, because I didn't recall what we were going to be speaking about, but in the back of my mind this morning was Planned Parenthood being responsible for 80 million abortions, and was it Madame Blavatsky or Margaret Sanger who was quoted as saying, "We need to ensure that the blacks don't realize that we're just trying to exterminate them."
Yeah, well, at that time, the eugenic component was far stronger than it is today. I must say that in the meantime, that they have sort of cleaned up their act somewhat in this respect, which is not to say that that blacks in the United States are not subjected, you know, to these methods to a greater extent than whites. But that doesn't have so much to do with their color as it has to do with the socioeconomic standing. To move on, another thing that came to my mind as you mentioned that you had forgotten what we were going to talk about is that you're flying by the seat of your pants.
Yeah, totally.
And so am I because I never have any chance to prepare in great detail for either the interviews or I never have any chance to write in at a leisurely pace. I'm so overworked and so
my preparation for interviews is restricted to making sure I eat something and make myself a cup of coffee.
I had my coffee prior to this.
Yeah,
but to continue with this grotesque list. 100% of the population subjected to chemical, biological fertility control methods have damaged endocrine systems, which result in chronic illness in at least 25% of these affected populations. And this is why we see, you know, all of these so-called illnesses of affluence. They are the result of this damage done to the endocrine system. All males subjected to chemical fertility control methods have compromised substandard sperm. So they're either completely infertile or subfertile. More than...
You know, it's interesting you should say that because I do meet a lot of people who oppose who I am and what I do, who I just... It occurs to me, you must have been conceived with a substandard sperm bank.
We're making light of this, but when you think about it, you know, just the helplessness our helplessness as a people is extraordinary because we are at the receiving end of a policy that has been going on for 7 decades. Now we could very well be the third or even the fourth generation exposed to these methods, right? So we have no conception of what it is even like to lead a life without being surrounded or bombarded by these poisons in our life that have been deliberately introduced, you know, for these demographic objectives and geopolitical objectives. The last item on my list is that more than 500 million people, that's half a billion people, have met with premature death due to artificially high levels of morbidity and mortality that have been achieved, you know, primarily by the introduction of the HIV virus in the population, but as well also as a result of the illness that is caused by these chemical biological agents. Now, this is the price that we have paid as a society. If you want, this is the price that we have paid for our affluence in the West. What has been averted, however, because had there not been a good reason to reach out to such desperate measures of population control, had there been not a good reason, this would have never happened. I cannot even begin to imagine how difficult it would have been to reach any kind of consensus, even behind closed doors, even among, you know, elites who are well informed and who have access to information and to all kinds of predictions as to where society is heading if we do nothing about it, if they do nothing about it, because really we are just victims. But as I have described, we are victims in a sense, but we are beneficiaries in another sense. What has been averted? And this is the short list of what has been averted. Well, had they not started with population control in 1945, civilization would have long collapsed because we could have never been able to support an additional 2 billion people an additional 2 billion people would have been born into the world between 1950 and now. So instead of 7 billion, we would have 9 billion by now. There's no way that our food production and our technology to produce food, our green revolution, would not have been able to compensate or to feed these additional 2 billion people. But we would have not even started on the long and arduous process of the demographic transition. That is to say, we would not have started to interfere with this growth, this natural population growth, which is, you know, which is like a pyramid. It's represented graphically like a pyramid with the very, very old at the top, the very young at the bottom. And this pyramid of population growth, it just broadens and broadens and broadens. It doubles every 30 or 40 years, depending on sort of sexual mores and on the culture. So we would have not even begun to interfere with our fertility and to reduce the population growth, which is a process that takes anywhere from 3 to 5 generations. So by now, if they had waited until today, when the population is 7 billion, even if they would have started, you know, in the most extreme way to reduce fertility and to increase mortality, it would have been too little, too late. Widespread famine would have destabilized Africa, South America, and Asia by the 1980s, causing universal misery and suffering of an order of magnitude that we have never experienced. There would have been billions of people starving to death. A Western world with a population twice as large as it is today, let's say we have approximately 800 million people, 800 million whites between North America, Europe, New Zealand, Australia, you know, some in South America, and so on. We would have been twice as many. Now, consider that whites or Westerners consume infinitely more resources due to our standard of living and our advanced technological society than people in the developing world. Already, with 800 million people, we consume over half of the world's resources. 800 million people today consume over half of the world's resources. That means that the remaining 6.2 billion people have to make do with the remaining 50% of the world's resources.
Well, part of that is the fact that manufacturers and consumerism kind of ideology has made them make everything with planned obsolescence. I mean, if things were built to last, I doubt that 800 million people would be consuming 90% of the resources, because most of those resources are simply wasted.
Yes, I will divert here a little bit from my list to address that point, the built-in obsolescence in our manufactured goods. And that came to be in order to keep people employed. You see, if they would have continued with manufacturing goods that last, you know, forever, or that last for a generation or two, there would have been that much less employment. So, of course, this is not does not fit in with a capitalist system where you have to create things, you have to manufacture things in order to create profit, and that profit turns into capital that can in turn be invested to create more things and to get even more capital. So to increase wealth in a capitalist society, you have to produce things. And that is why this built-in obsolescence has been introduced sometimes.
Do you think that maybe it's stifled human creativity somewhat by getting everybody to work a job making stuff that doesn't last and doesn't matter, rather than actually having time to think, time to create, time to pioneer?
Well, this has been really the result of dire situation, of circumstances, of the desperation of governments to keep people employed. You know, an ever-growing population, everybody looking for work. And once this population spilled out of the countryside and could no longer be employed, you know, on farms and in agriculture, and started invading the cities, which is what happened in England at the end of the 19th century, which is why London's population exploded and you had this this terrible poverty because there was absolutely no system of social welfare to accommodate these people. It was something completely new, a complete reversal or disruption of the balance of society, where before in agrarian times or pre-industrial times, the population was overwhelmingly 90% of it was employed in agriculture on the farms.
Not to mention on these farms and everything, they had something that that doesn't exist in cities, a sense of community.
Yes, well, there's no doubt that society was altered in cultural ways to a completely unrecognizable form, and that process continues because we're no longer an agrarian society or a rural society. We're now an industrial society and an urban society. 80% of Westerners live in cities; they don't live in the countryside anymore.
And this reminds me of back in the 30s, I believe it was during the Great Depression. A statistic that I heard that during that depression, 10 million Americans starved to death. That's back during that population era. I'm not sure how many people there were living in the United States at that time. And at that time, 90% of people lived in rural areas and grew their own food. That and 10 million people still starve to death. Today, as you say, 80% of people live in urban areas and don't grow their own food. So you could imagine what a depression would do, how massive the population would be reduced by simply through starvation.
This is a very good point you make, and one that I've addressed in one of my articles in a series called Survival or Extinction. And which is why governments now are in such a desperate mode, if you want. They realize that in a modern society, people have no food independence. They're completely reliant on income. And you cannot have an income without a job. So this chronic unemployment that has developed due to the modernization of our manufacturing processes, where you know everything is digitized and mechanized and computerized, it's eliminating more and more jobs, and it is becoming impossible for governments to employ people. So unemployment has become chronic. But chronic unemployment in a fully monetized economy spells disaster. Why? Because without an income, you cannot survive. You cannot feed yourself and your family. It is not as though in the past, you know, you had a patch of land, a few acres, and you can plant, you know, just enough food so you can practice subsistence farming, which is still the case in the developing world in many countries. Now all of us are completely dependent on the ability of society, of modern agriculture, to make food, you know, cheap and universally available. But we're losing the ability to buy this food, even though it is cheap and universally available in the West and abundant, right? Because we don't have jobs. We don't have jobs because of modern society. So it is a circle that we you know, a cycle now that we cannot escape, and nobody knows how to solve it.
I think education plays a big part in this, because I think the modern education system was brought about in order to meet the needs of industrialism in the first place. So they were breeding basically human beings that had had their sense of creativity and entrepreneurship disabled so that they could be more readily utilized into the workforce, follow orders blindly, and be much, much more easy to control for employers. And I think that this is the very reason why people have become in such a state of crisis, because everything that is part of the human faculty to solve crisis, to create solutions, has been destroyed deliberately by the establishment in order to support itself.
I would go even further and say that before there was a deliberate attempt, you know, to engineer the social outcome, we became victims of circumstances, if you want. Why? I've just explained how we lost the ability to be independent in the manner in which we grow food. And I explained how we became dependent on an industrial society to supply us with jobs so that we can buy the food produced through industrial means and no longer on family farms. So we having lost that independence, we have become more enfeebled, if you want. And governments were looking, you know, for solutions, and they had absolutely no roadmap to follow, because humanity has never been in this situation. We encountered this transition now from an agrarian society to a industrial society, and now from an industrial society to a post-industrial society. We're going blindly. There is no roadmap to follow. There are no textbooks to follow. Nobody really knows how to solve these problems. So we solve them as we go along. And of course, the political process now has become completely inadequate, because we are working with national institutions in an international world order. And these national institutions are completely inadequate and inept in solving these international problems. That's why globalization is now proceeding at a desperate pace, in order to build this political and institutional infrastructure necessary to solve today's problems. Unprecedented problems.
Well, you're right. And what occurred to me as you were speaking was that they've managed to identify that the crisis, more or less, is a lack of individual personal responsibility, creativity, that kind of thing. These things have been systematically destroyed in favor of blind faith in authoritarian figures. And I think, what was the other element that I was going to say here? Blind faith and collectivism. Collectivism is ultimately the massive problem here, because people expect everybody else to solve their problems. Had the elite and what have you structured a society whereby each and every individual was empowered to solve problems, take personal responsibility, be creative and what have you, I would be surprised if our current society wasn't a hell of a lot better off in the short term and in the long term. However, because they have failed in their attempt to fully collectivize and support society at the same time, their answer is to collectivize it even further, to the point where individual responsibility and creativity doesn't exist anymore at all to oppose their system. I think the word is insane.
What you are describing, in a sense, are also the effects of a modern society and of a modern economy. We are so compartmentalized now in our duties and functions, and therefore so completely dependent on others doing a million other functions. We become so super specialized, that unless the system works smoothly, our dependence now on one another is so great, and our inability to be independent is so great, that we can no longer even envision, a return to the good old days. It's just simply not possible. This is really a function of a modern, technically and scientifically advanced society. I mean, the bank of knowledge, the quantity of knowledge that is inherent in modern society is so huge that a single person can no longer acquire that. Mm. Up to about the 15th, 16th century, you still had the concept of the so-called uomo universale, the universal man. An intellectual like Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo and so on, who were very intelligent and who acquired knowledge from every field of knowledge at that time, and they could just about barely encompass all of human knowledge within one human brain. That is no longer possible today. Knowledge has grown exponentially. And therefore, specialization has grown exponentially, because there's just too much to know, too many processes, and society has become too complex. And now we are dependent on one another. Mm. We can no longer even hope to have independence. If, let's say, we were to return to the farm, which is possible, and some people do, they return to the farm, but in no time at all, they find out that life on the farm and being independent is very, very difficult, and that the standard of living is nowhere near, what one can have by being part of this this modern complex society and fulfilling just one small role in this huge complex that civilization has become.
Oh, you're right. And I had the privilege of talking with a guy who calls himself Thunder. He's a quantum mechanics physicist and what have you. And he grew up on a farm in Iowa, and some of the technology that his father and his family pioneered on that farm would actually be really, really good in terms of use today, and it was quite advanced for its time. But the problem is people just don't seem to catch on. And we're talking about independence here and how there's X amount of unfathomable, huge, giant knowledge that specialists will take sections of it, and that's how society runs. Mm-hmm. There's basics, though. For example, my soon-to-be wife, Sarah, she was taught by her parents in South Africa how to sew, mend clothing and make clothing by her mother, and how to grow food and how to construct simple things, right? And just those very, very simple things about how to clothe yourself, how to feed yourself, and how to provide a shelter for yourself is not taught almost at all anymore. And those are very basic skills that can save your life. And they're not that hard to learn, nor do they take an exorbitant amount of time. And you can specialize in anything else after you've got your basics right, I think.
We are so divorced from the land now, so removed from the land and from a life on the farm, that many of us, even though they might have the interest or the will, they don't have the opportunity. First of all, they live, you know, in these mega cities, completely surrounded by the concrete jungle. And the prospect of spending time on the farm is almost a dream. I am one of perhaps the last generation to have benefited, you know, from that kind of an education. And only because my father was a farm boy. Even though he was a medical doctor, he was, you know, he never lost the love of the land, and he put together, you know, a kind of like a city farm, and we had animals, and we had a huge garden, and he made me, dig in the ground and plant and grow and, you know, clean up after the animals, and taught me about animal
husbandry
and about agriculture. So, and I still have that knowledge, but of course I'm not applying it because I don't have the land. If I had the land, and I'm hoping that one day I will have a patch of land, I would love to, you know, to put those skills to good use. But most of the population in the Western world, which is, as I said, 80% urban, never has a chance to learn even the basics.
Well, I did see an incredible article in Japan where they have zero land. Zero. They've created a culture. There's actually a subset culture whereby growing food indoors out of even just little aluminium cans and what have you, where they actually turn it into an art thing. So you'll grow herbs all around your house, all different types of herbs and little cans, pretty much everywhere where there's a window sill or a light or anything like that. Some people use bookshelves that are lined with the food and what have you being produced, and they would even decorate and paint all of these cans and what have you. So the ability for people to come up with creative ways of using land, I think, is quite beautiful. But the fact of the matter is, if you don't have enough land to grow enough food, there ain't going to be any way that people can survive. And it's just that simple, you know, garbage in, garbage out.
Well, this is why the depopulation policy came to be. We've simply reached the limits of our ability to grow food and feed all the people that are being born into the world. And that was, you know, foreseen as early as 1945. Of course, famine is not something that we've experienced just in the modern era. I mean, this has been a struggle throughout history. And there are innumerable examples when conflict has resulted because of a lack of food, and famines have killed thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people throughout history. Now it's just the dimension of the problem that is greater than ever before. Of course, we have, you know, at our disposal more technological fixes and tools than ever before. But also, we have reached the ends of our natural resources, and we have overstretched everything. So, you know, this realization was made in 1945, and thank goodness somebody did. And that's how the global depopulation policy came to be. This consensus was easily made because, you know, people saw the writing on the wall. The experts saw the writing on the wall, and they realized if they don't do something about it, we're all going to be doomed.
I recall a story. There was a mathematician and a king, and the king wanted something from the mathematician, a formula or something of that nature. And the king asked the mathematician, "How do you want to be paid?" And he says, "I want you to pay me in grain." And he grabbed a chessboard, and he said he placed one grain on the first square and two grains on the second square. And he says, "I want you to double every single time the next square comes up." So the third square would be four grain, and the next square after that would be eight grain. And the king laughed at him, and he said, "This is easy. This is no problem. This is going to be a piece of cake. I can pay you that with my chump change in my pocket." Little did he know that mathematical exponentialism through that kind of doubling process meant that he actually wound up bankrupting himself trying to pay that mathematician, because he was unable to even provide any payment of any kind anywhere near sufficient in order to pay what the mathematician's fee was. And this, I think, is an important lesson when we talk about population growth or anything that's growing, is that it can soon go out of control.
Yes, population growth, you know, can uninterfered population growth, natural population growth is exponential. In the old days, prior to the Second World War, most families had four children or more, and most of these children survived. Of course, so the potential for a doubling of the population every 20, 30 years is always there in a population that has natural growth. And, of course, the ability to grow food, to increase food production at the same rate, at the same exponential rate as the population growth, is impossible. And that is why, throughout history, we have outgrown our food supplies and run into trouble. And it was only at the end of the Second World War, after having gone through the misery of two world wars because of resource scarcity, by the way, that it was realized that somehow we have to break out of this cycle of misery, this cycle of poverty. We have to cheat, you know, if you want, nature, and outsmart nature. And the people who started the global depopulation policy have always had the best intentions. And I can imagine that at the beginning they also tried to implement it openly, that is, overtly through legislation. But that was not possible. And, of course, we discussed that in the last interview, why that was not possible. But to go back to what you said about the Japanese, it's interesting you mentioned the Japanese, because, yes, first of all, they, because of them living in a country that is completely overcrowded, they're expert at using space. You see that in their apartments and the way they furnish them. And now you mentioned an example in the way they grow, you know, food in every little space.
You see it in their technology. They've managed to compress everything down into the smallest size possible.
Yes. Also, another aspect that I want to mention about the Japanese, when I lived in British Columbia, that's on the west coast of Canada, and I was engaged to a young lady who was an English as a second language instructor, and who taught English to Japanese students. And we always had a Japanese student staying with us in our house over the summer, or even throughout the year. And one thing I've noticed, whenever we took the Japanese students on trips, you know, through the countryside or to see places, and of course British Columbia is absolutely stunningly beautiful. It's like New Zealand, just glorious nature, where, you know, it's a, they call it God's country. But the Japanese are so removed from nature, so divorced from nature. These children have never, you know, been in the countryside. They've always been in the big cities, surrounded by jungle. They had absolutely no interest in nature. They would fall asleep in the bus and miss all of that beautiful scenery. And I was just getting exasperatingly frustrated, you know, that they had absolutely no appreciation for the beauty of nature anymore. And this is the danger we have now as we raise, you know, new generations completely removed from nature inside these concrete jungles. They just have no conception and no appreciation for the beauty of nature and for the, you know, for the the biotopes that make life possible on this planet. And this is very, very dangerous development. Of course, you as a New Zealander probably cannot even fathom that. How can that be possible? Because you're surrounded by glorious nature.
No, and I'm not. I'm surrounded by an ever-expanding concrete jungle just like everywhere else in the world. I mean, everybody lives in a concrete jungle nowadays. I have seen the countryside. I have been to it and what have you, and I have seen it, and I do appreciate it. But at the end of the day, I spend 99% of my time surrounded by a tyrannical police state concrete jungle full of surveillance cameras and pollution, just like everybody else.
Nevertheless, as a New Zealander and as a Canadian, nature is never far away. It is within reach. But I spent 4 months in China in 2005, and I lived in Shanghai, which is, you know, a city of over 20 million people. And oftentimes we took trips to neighboring cities like Shenzhen and Suzhou, and we were looking forward to see the countryside in between. Of course, we would hop on the train, and the train would, you know, we'd go on a 2-hour, 3-hour train ride, but the city would never stop. The delineation between, you know, Suzhou or Guangzhou and the city of Shanghai was just not there. There was no countryside in between. The cities had grown to such an extent, these megalopolises had grown to such an extent that they had become one, you know, mega city that would stretch for hundreds and hundreds of kilometers. And basically the entire seaboard of China is one big city. Even though it has, you know, different names, it is one continuous big city. Mm. Now, the Chinese really have no opportunity anymore. These children who grew up in these concrete jungles have no opportunity to even hope to see Mother Nature, you know, by going, you know, somewhere which is still pristine. There are no pristine places in China. Because the population is so huge, and the cities have become, you know, just glued together.
I would agree with you in terms of the urbanized areas, but I was talking with some people the other day. Who was it? I forget. But I was talking with my mother actually. My brother's married a Tahitian girl who's of Chinese descent. And they went to see their relatives in China, and they live in these rural areas where for hundreds of miles in every direction there is nothing, and they're still using buffaloes and carts to get around, and they live in huts with dirt floors. And so there is that section that still exists. It's kind of like what happens with urbanization is it's very much similar to the way digital technology works. When I was in university, I learned about this phenomenon called the digital divide, whereby one section of the population, i.e. Western culture, has digital technology, and so our culture advances that much faster than those who do not have access to digital technology. And I think it's a very similar phenomenon with those experiencing urbanization, but between those who do not, in fact, have access to that kind of technology within their little rural communities. It's kind of like pockets of humanity out there that are still doing things as they did 1,000 years ago, and nothing's changed.
Yes, absolutely. With higher population density and urbanization, you have to simply, because of the physical lack of space, you have to come up with inventive solutions, you know, to solve problems. You have to come up with, you know, all kinds of rules in order to coexist peacefully. Mm. Now, So you're forever. It's a forever an organic and a changing environment, and yes. This is why it promotes innovation.
It's like there's this innovation that we come up with cars, for example. One person said to me the other day, Vinny, I think we're trying to burn up too much technology. Would you rather we all be walking around with horse and cart and what have you? You can imagine how much horse manure would be on the streets if everybody was still on horseback.
And how many horses you would need?
Yeah.
We need 7 million horses. Already, we don't even have enough land to grow, to raise cows or sheep.
We don't even have enough land to ride into the sunset.
But you mentioned that in China you still have, these rural places, and you do. And the reason you still have them and that are so, still so pristine, if you want, is because the Chinese government has gone out of its way to segregate, to separate the two populations, the urban and the rural. So they have this system called the hukou system, which prevents people from the countryside to move into the cities. So if you want to leave a village and move into the city, you become an illegal immigrant within your own country, within China. It's very, very difficult. And then you are deprived of access to schools for your children, of medical help, and so on. So the Chinese government has gone out of its way to prevent urbanization or to slow down urbanization, and even so, it has grown exponentially. But the hukou system still prevents a large segment of the Chinese population from moving into the cities, and that way the government can control the process of urbanization. And so that's why you still have these pockets of rural life that seem to be undisturbed in China, whereas you don't have them anywhere else. But to move back to go back to our list or short list of what has been averted, if I may return to the subject, may I?
Go for your life.
Okay, we've deviated. Now, another thing that they have saved us from that they have averted through the global depopulation policy is greater environmental degradation than we face today. Because had there been an extra 2 billion people that would have needed to be accommodated with food and land and housing, clothing and so on, sewage, yes, we would have had none of the protected tracts of land now that have been set aside as national parks and so on. We would have had to dip into these protected areas just to meet the immediate demand. And you see this problem continuously today in countries like Brazil, where there is continuous encroachment on the Amazon jungle. The slash and burn, people are just simply trying to make a living, so they're burning the forest, growing crops, and they're just eating into the Amazon forest little by little, and hundreds of thousands of hectares are disappearing every year. Now imagine if we would have had to accommodate another 2 billion people. We would have had absolutely no tundra left, in Siberia. We would have had no taiga left in Siberia, no pristine forests in the Amazon, and even the Canadian forests would have all been gone. That is the reality of it. So the environmental degradation and devastation would have been far greater than it is today, and we would have been unable to save anything. We would have just resorted to desperate exploitation. And last but not least, there would have been no peace and prosperity in large parts of the world because we would have had to share share the same resources with an ever-growing population. And that would have eventually led to conflict, and that would have eventually led to nuclear war and nuclear annihilation. That much is certain. But what will happen if we continue, if the methods that are used today, these covert, biological, chemical, bacteriological methods are continuously used into the future, what will happen? Now, I try to, to think, crunch the numbers and to predict what will happen, given the results that we've experienced so far. And this is the short list I've come up with. 2 out of 4 women worldwide will be infertile by 2050, by the middle of the 21st century, and 3 out of 4 by the end of the 21st century, by 2100. 2 billion genetic lines will be terminated by 2050, and 4 billion by 2100, simply because they will no longer be able to procreate. Their genetic lines their ability to make children will be shut down, as we see already in the Western world, where in countries like Italy and Switzerland, one out of four women cannot have children or do not have children. And in countries like Canada, the United States, New Zealand, one out of five women cannot or do not have children. The IQ will be lowered from an average of circa 90 today to an average of 70 by 2050 and to an average of probably of 50 by 2100.
Oh my God.
Keep in mind that mental retardation starts around 50. An IQ of 50 is considered mentally retarded. Now, in the Western world, and in the Western world, yes, we have an average IQ of about 90, 92, 93. Other countries, in African countries, apparently the IQ is lower. But that could very well be a function of, you know, how these tests are done. However, what is clear is that every generation subjected to chemical methods of population control, of which are fertility depressants, lose about 5 IQ points.
Fluoride does that.
Fluoride, yes, does that. And God knows what GMOs will do, because we have no experience with them, and we do not know. So we simply do not know the long-term effects of genetically modified...
Well, they have done studies on rodents and have determined that it takes 3 generations, I think, of mammals eating GMO food before they become completely sterilized.
Yes. Yes, and of course, my guess is that they can fiddle with the seeds, with GMO seeds, to cause sterilization within one generation, if that's what they want. However, this is not desirable, because they cannot hide the fact. Then, you know, if this is gradual, if it happens over multiple generations, then they can always say, well, this is the result of affluence, this is the result of environmental factors. You know, there's always an excuse for it.
So that's it's deception. It's deception for the greater good.
Yes.
And I always wondered this moral paradox. Is deception for the greater good at all? Can it possibly be? Had the population let's say, you know, you've got a problem in your family, like an addiction, or you have an intervention or something like that. It's because people are being honest with themselves, and then they go out and they solve said problem, because they now know and they now admit to themselves that said problem exists. Yeah. This is a way of solving a problem without anybody even realizing that there is a problem to solve, and in so doing, they lose their problem-solving's ability permanently.
You asked a philosophical question that goes to the core of this problem, and of course we can spend, you know, the next 2 days discussing that. Deception. The short answer to your question is deception is okay for a very short period of time when you just have no other alternative. Sooner or later, that catches up with you, and deception becomes, you know, a huge liability, because it results in complete disaster.
It has a snowballing effect, I've found, yes. You know.
It's just like, you know, you lie once, then to cover up that one lie, you have to lie twice, and then your entire life, your entire system becomes one big lie. And that's exactly what we have now. Yeah. Our entire Western system has become one giant lie. And in order to protect this, you know, these truths, these inconvenient truths, we have this system of surveillance and censorship and control that is growing more and more intrusive and oppressive from year to year, because the lie has grown to such proportion that it is just bursting to explode. Truth has a way of wanting to surface, and it's bursting to surface. You know, you and I are, you know, the vehicles of the truth bursting to the surface. And of course, the authorities are trying to prevent this by all means necessary. But now they've realized that is no longer possible, one, and it is no longer desirable, two. Why? Because they know now. There is no more a doubt. There is no way of even lying to themselves that these methods do not cause, you know, tremendous damage to the intellectual and genetic endowment of humanity. And if they continue, then we're going to end up annihilating ourselves.
Yes.
Well, to continue...
I would like to just make two quick statements there. I think the Mark Twain quotes. He said... If you don't lie, you don't have to have a very good memory. And and he also said it's far easier to convince somebody of a lie than it is to convince them that they've been lied to.
Yes, well, especially when the entire system is geared towards keeping the deception and promoting lies. And this is what we, you know, you and I, this is what we are breaking through. Where this is the matrix of control. This is what has become known as the matrix. And this matrix of control has this element of deception and lies. And it has come to this, you know, gradually, not because it was not intentional. It has come to this gradually because we have always chosen, you know, the lesser evil and the easiest way possible. And the easiest way possible is not always the best way possible, the best way. And that's the problem that we have in the West. You know, China, for instance, they've introduced the one-child policy, and that's it. Everything is in the open, right? Everybody respects the law or else...
they go to a forced labor camp.
Yes. So, you know, we've been blaming the Chinese and criticizing them, but with respect to how they address population, the population explosion, they're the only ones who have done it properly. And of course, we have a lot to learn from the Chinese. And my guess is that within the next 10 years or so, we will very much follow their model because there's no other way.
I was at a protest in Auckland once, and this Chinese lady came up to me and she said, "Well, what's going on here? What are all these people? What are all these people standing around here with signs and blaring through megaphones and what have you?" And I go, "It's a protest." And she goes, "What's a protest?" And I say, "You never seen one before, have you?" She lived in China, where every single protest results in everybody being arrested and killed.
Yeah.
Yes. And I don't think we have a good... And that is a good lesson to learn from the Chinese. You know,
also, the reason Chinese society is so overregulated, so oppressive, is because they don't have the luxury of a lot of land and a lot of wealth to share. Everything there is stretched to the maximum. You know, they live in such close quarters with such few resources. They have to share and they have to, you know, to sort of respect each other's boundaries to such an extent that everything is completely overregulated, and the government is paranoid that if they lose control, everything can fall apart in no time at all. And this is one of the results. Yes, and this is one of the long-term results of overpopulation. Mm. If we had not addressed the population problem in covert ways, we would have had
a similarly oppressive state by now as well, wouldn't we?
We would have had even more so. Why? Because Westerners are far more aggressive individually. You know, we are far more. Throughout history, we've been far more aggressive. This is why we've expanded outward. You know, we've conquered other people's continents. We've taken away the land from others, and this is why
I think that was
all over the place.
I think that's actually because we could. We had we had the technology to oppress and conquer and enslave other people. And so we're just like, hey, I don't have to earn this. I don't have to be nice. I can just freaking take it. And I think this gave rise to the powerful domination of society by control freak psychopaths who are unable to be unseated from power without immense resistance from the host population. The problem is the host population have been manipulated so well by psychopaths who are adept at lying and lying believably that they think that we need these psychopathic control freaks to run our lives. And you were talking about China, and I recall a article in the Daily Mail, I believe. It was something along the lines of human battery farms in Hong Kong, these giant apartment structures where twice the size of a single bed is your apartment.
Yeah.
Literally. You're in a human battery farm. All of your cooking equipment and everything is in there. All of your clothing, all of your possessions, and your bed, and your everything is crammed into that. And it must be a terrible, horrific way to live.
I've lived in Hong Kong, and I've experienced that, you know, the closet-sized apartments. And this is what we would have all had to contend with had there been no interference with our fertility and had population growth continued naturally. Mm. So, you know, for better or worse, one of the benefits that we've drawn, you know, from population covert population control is that our affluence has been preserved and increased.
Indeed.
And, you know, we complain all we want, but had there not been these covert methods, we would have had no affluence whatsoever in the West. We would have been as poor as anybody else and as desperate as everybody else, living in closets just like in Hong Kong. And I tell you, it's not a pleasant thing. I lived in those closets in Hong Kong. I know what it is like.
Yeah.
A 500 square foot apartment in Hong Kong costs $500,000, the same as a mansion in Canada. You can buy a mansion in Canada for 5,000 square feet with the same amount of money as you would have to pay for a 500 square foot apartment. So 10 times less space in Hong Kong.
Wow. Okay, well, finish your point and then we're going to go to break.
Well, let me just go through the list quickly. I have a couple more. Do we have time?
We've got 2 more hours. So let's just take a break now, because I badly need to take a wiki leak. And we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break with the amazing Kevin Galilee. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number 2 of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast. Go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. And make a donation, or preferably, if you can subscribe and donate on a regular basis, just a few dollars a month or what have you, it keeps this little operation going here. This is a unique way of doing things. It's sort of like a business / charity / exposing scumbaggery. I don't know how much success it's going to have in the future. I'm just kind of pioneering this new model. My theory is that if I do a hell of a lot of good for a hell of a lot of people, that a few people, just a few, will do something good for me so that I can just keep doing it. That's my theory. I may be proven wrong in time, but this is the third plus year of the Vinnie Eastwood Show using this model, and it's only gotten bigger and better thanks to the relatively small number, considering the listening audience that I have in terms of visits to the website, who contribute, who actually value this show that they don't have to pay for enough to give something out of the kindness of their hearts. And I want to iterate just how freaking grateful I am just for the opportunity to spend 5 days a week exposing scumbaggery for the betterment of humanity. It is a privilege. It is a privilege, and I am honored that anybody would even come out to support me in such a way. And so many of these donations that I have received, because I'm working so hard, I don't even have enough time to send you all emails back to thank you personally for donating to me from the bottom of my heart. I don't even have the time to do that, and I feel really guilty about it. And I want to iterate to anybody who listens to this radio broadcast on a regular basis, who has contributed, that I have not thanked. Thank you very much. I couldn't do it without you. Now, Kevin Galilee is my guest. Kevin, do you have a website there?
Yes, well, not a personal website anymore, because as you well know, I've been in prison 6 times over the past 3 years, and my entire financial independence has been destroyed, and with it, my previous websites. But I do have several, I'm using the social media, and I several outfits support my work, and they have dedicated pages to me. And I will give you a list that you can post along with the archived interview when you are done. It's a list of about 6 or 7 websites that carry my work, and my publications, and my profile, and my history, because it is quite a colorful history in the meantime. One that I suspect sooner or later will make into a Hollywood movie. It has been that exciting and that crazy over the past 4 years. And it is a miracle that I'm still standing here, and I have come through this unscathed. But since I have earned the right to speak freely and to say things that nobody in government can, or nobody in the who's part of the international superstructure can, I am going to make a full use of that. Before I continue with my subject, I just want to say that what you are doing, Vinny, is absolutely invaluable. And I hope that your listeners will support you accordingly, because you deserve it. You have opened new avenues for me. And actually, you should know that shortly after you interviewed me in November, I was approached by the Civil Rights Party of Canada. And they have offered me the second highest position within the party as a deputy prime minister in waiting. And I've accepted it, but not only have they done that, they have fully adopted my own principles. And of course, I probably would not have come to their attention had it not been for your interview. Your interview has contributed to that, has brought me into the public eye, and has resulted in other interviews here in Canada. So it's you have broken the ice for me in New Zealand, and I'm Canadian. And Canada has learned from you. And it is only because you broke the ice and let out this, you know, this huge cat out of the bag, so to say, that others in Canada had the courage to follow your example and let me speak, let me address my Canadian fellow citizens. Surprisingly, due to the internet and to your courage, I was able to address New Zealanders before I could address my fellow Canadians. And that is somewhat an embarrassment for my country. And I suppose that that is going to weigh heavily on the reputation of the Canadian media, which is abysmal.
Well, I share that embarrassment. Do you know how many alternative radio hosts and filmmakers there are in New Zealand that do 5 days a week?
Probably zero.
No, there's one.
Outside of you, yes.
Yeah. There's 4 million New Zealanders, and there's only one Vinny Eastwood. And just like you, that doesn't make me proud of what I'm accomplishing. It makes me ashamed of my countrymen.
I hear you. And in fact, my shame to carry a Canadian passport and a Romanian passport, because I'm Romanian by birth, has resulted in me abdicating both my Canadian and Romanian citizenship. I returned my passports to the respective heads of state. However, Romania has kept my passport, has not even acknowledged receipt of it, but has not mentioned anything. Canada could not keep my passport because the United Nations prevents governments from taking away or accepting, you know, citizens' citizenship unless that citizen has been accepted by another country. So because they don't want stateless people, you know, floating around with no status from one country to country. But for all intents and purposes, I gave up my Canadian citizenship and my Romanian citizenship because I'm ashamed of these countries. You know, I came to Canada in 1985, and because I had high respect for this country. That respect has completely evaporated because the country that I immigrated to no longer exists. The rule of law, respect for human rights, and democratic processes have been completely eviscerated in Canada. Canada is now a phony democracy, just like any other democracy in the world. And I explain that in my work, especially the series of articles that I've mentioned, Survival or Extinction, which will become a book probably in about 3 months' time. But to go back to the subject at hand, the global depopulation policy, we came to a break and while I was in the middle of my short list of the tragedy to come. And within this short list, I was describing how the global depopulation policy has saved us from nuclear annihilation, mass starvation, and environmental devastation. But that if continuing with these covert methods will result in the annihilation of humanity. So this list is a list of projections and estimates for the next 100 years as to what will happen if these covert methods continue, which they can't. So I mentioned that two out of four women worldwide will be infertile by 2050, 3 out of 4 by 2100. 2 billion genetic lines will be terminated by 2050, and 4 billion by 2100. The IQ will be lowered worldwide from an average of 90, which is where it is today, to an average of about 70 by 2050, and to an average of about 50 by 2100. Which means that the majority of the population will be, for all intents and purposes, mentally retarded. So that will be, mental retardation will be the norm rather than exception. Of course, in the Western world, we see an ever greater number of the population or segment of the population being, you know, intellectually incapable of functioning. And that's the result of...
Anybody who watches Mark Dice's videos where he goes around and asks people simple questions would think that that is happening already.
Well, sure. Of course it's happening. This is why everything is being dumbed down. This is why now the curriculum in school is 2 years what it was 50 years ago, 2 years behind what it was 50 years ago. So there's no doubt that there has been a huge deterioration in the mental aptitude of the Western world. And that is also visible in the fact that the incidence of genius among children in China is 3 times higher now than it is in children in the Western world. And that could have not always been the case simply because our scientific and technological advantage would have come from our intellectual ability. And we would not have had this or gained this intellectual scientific and technological advantage had we not been at par intellectually with the Chinese. That is no longer the case. And why is that no longer the case? Because for the past 68 years, our children, us, we have been subjected to chemical and biological poisons that have altered and undermined our genetic and intellectual endowment. And this is the result of that. And it cannot continue. If it continues, we'll all be retarded in a century or so. Now, to continue with the list. That's where we were left before the break. Half the population will be sexually confused. Now we have an incidence of about 15% of the population being sexually confused. That is to say, is one either, you know, lesbian, homosexual, bisexual, or transsexual. Now the normal or incidence of aberrant sexual behavior, if you want, is about 3 to 4%. Now, of course, because Western society, Western nations have been subjected to these chemical poisons, the occurrence of sexual confusion is now around 15%, so 3 to 4 times higher than normally. Half of the world's children will suffer from developmental disorders by the end of the 21st century if this nonsense continues. 9 out of 10 people worldwide will have severely damaged endocrine systems, resulting in chronic illness in at least 3/4 of the population. Now we have chronic illness in about 25% of the population, that is to say 1/4 of the population. But as I said, the damage is cumulative and it is greater from generation to generation. Life expectancy will sink from an average of 70 years today, which is what it is worldwide, to 60 years by 2050, and to 50 years by 2100. We already see this kind of shortening of the lifespan in countries like the Soviet Union, in Russia, where over the past 20 years, the lifespan, especially among males, has gone down from, I think it was at 71, has gone down to about 54.
I spoke to a Russian about that. And they said it's unsurprising because I think they even had to institute a minimum price for vodka. It's about $1 a bottle of vodka, right? That's how cheap it is. And there's an extraordinary amount of vodka being drank, extraordinarily amount of cigarettes being smoked, because there ain't no employment opportunities in a large part for the population of Russia. And as a result, there's this social degradation that has a real physical effect on the body, and that affects the life expectancy massively.
Yes, and of course, alcohol in Russia has been deliberately pushed, and the price has been made so cheap, and it's cheaper than water, basically, or pop. This has been deliberate in order to undermine human health and to shorten lifespans, which is in tune with the goals of the global depopulation policy. Now, Russia has chosen alcohol. China has chosen tobacco to achieve the same goal. And, of course, the West has chosen drugs to do that. And I describe that in my book for anybody who is interested in details. But the last point on my short list here is that 9 out of 10 males worldwide will have useless sperm by the end of the 21st century if this methodology continues. That is what we're facing. If we think that we can continue with the deception and choose, you know, the easy way out by avoiding to confront the overpopulation problem and doing our part voluntarily rather than being forced upon us through covert methods. So one way or another, we're going to pay a price. Whether we want to admit it or not, we will pay a price, and the price will be irrevocable and will annihilate us if we continue to close our eyes and pretend that this is going to go away. This problem is not going away. One way or another, we're going to be dead. Whether we address this problem openly, whether we succeed in addressing this problem openly, will decide whether we survive as a species or we're going to go the way of the dinosaurs. So now I want to start talking about in greater detail about the consequences, the direct, indirect, and unintended consequences of the covert methods of depopulation.
Or, as I call it, the unintended consequences, where there are layers upon layers of unintended consequences. Yes.
Which is actually what we'll be doing. We will be peeling the layers from this stinky onion, which is the global depopulation policy.
Well, let's hope it doesn't make us cry. Go for your life.
It'll certainly bring tears to our eyes. I feel sorry for people who are listening to this for the first time and who are hearing that such a thing as a global depopulation policy exists, and they're hearing that, you know, from my mouth by listening to this interview for the first time, because this is a shock, a body blow of major proportions that will completely alter somebody's view of the world and destroy, you know, the illusion that we live in a society that is free and democratic. That is certainly not the case, and it's not because our leaders have intentionally tried, you know, to usurp our democratic rights. It's because we are dealing with a program of global proportions to solve, you know, problems that are global and that eschew easy solutions. This is, you know, has grown step by step, and we are in this mess because we have refused to look at the hard facts and to face the bitter reality. Now, people who are listening to me now will be facing the bitter reality because I present the facts unadulterated, as they are, as painful as they are, and without, you know, considering people's sensitivities, be they religious or political or moral. The facts are what they are, and unless we confront them head on, we are all doomed. Now, the consequences. We reap what we sow. This wisdom, you know, cannot be ignored. There is hardly an aspect of our lives that is not affected in one way or another the necessities of the global depopulation policy. And there is hardly a person on the planet who is not touched both directly and indirectly by the measures of depopulation, regardless of where you live. The only people who can really claim to be outside the reach of the global depopulation policy are the isolated tribes of the Amazon and other such scattered people living in remote and inaccessible parts of the globe, far away from civilization. So let's start with the direct consequences. Now, obviously, any attempt at social engineering will have a cascading effect, and some effects will be expected and others unexpected. One of the most obvious effects of implementing a secret, covert policy that undermines our reproductive freedom and subverts our fertility is that the governments that we have in place now are, for all intents and purposes, illegitimate governments and false democracies. A policy that can only be implemented in secret and against the will of the people will obviously, by necessity, require bypassing the democratic process. Because voters would never give their consent to their governments to poison them to infertility and to chronic and debilitating illness. They would never agree to that. They would never give governments the consent to do that.
Unless the government lies to them and tells them that the poisons and so forth that they're giving them are good for their teeth.
For your teeth, yes, of course. And that's how they've been getting away with it. And I will discuss that under the section of the ethical consequences of this policy, because that's where it properly belongs. Now, governments exist to ensure the security of the people, not to subvert it. And obviously, by poisoning our environment, our basic elements of life, you know, food and water, in order to subvert our reproductive rights and our human fertility, it is with dire consequences for our health and to our lives, is obviously not ensuring our security, but subverting our security. So the global depopulation policy has turned the role of government upside down, because it has annihilated the social contract that exists between the voters, between the electorate, and politicians and the leadership. And this has rendered every Western government that perversely claims to be democratic the very opposite. It is not democratic. This is not democracy. This means that since 1945, because this policy has been in effect since 1945, and it has been spreading, you know, by leaps and bounds since 1950 in its methodology, that means that since 1945, the world has not known democracy, but only the illusion of democracy, and a perverted one at that.
Of course, the meaning of democracy derived from the Latin, demos means the mob, and kratos means rule, so it's mob rule. So I disagree. I think we have had mob rule for quite some time.
Well, this, you know, these decisions that have enabled the global depopulation policy have definitely not been made by the mob, but by elites. And I explain why that came to be and why that was the only way that was the only way possible in my next book.
Of course. However, mob rule is usually established because a demagogue manipulates the mob into making a decision, and that's our crowd psychology working in there. But yes, I'm sorry. Continue.
Sure. If it's done, you know, with ill intent, then it's manipulation. If it's done with good intent, then it is persuasion. So it's a degree of semantics there as well. What is the second political consequence that derives from this policy? Well, it's the abnegation of the rule of law and structural violence. That is to say, there is no rule of law. We cannot speak of the rule of law when we live in the middle of a genocide. We are at the receiving end of a genocide. Of course, genocide is a crime against humanity, and to speak that, to pretend that there is a rule of law, while at the same time our governments are subjecting us to, you know, genocidal methods of population control, is ridiculous. This is obviously not possible. You cannot, the government cannot engage in genocide against us while at the same time maintaining that it preserves the rule of law. That is not the case. And since legality is the basis of legitimacy, any government that does not follow the rule of law is not legitimate. And the depopulation policy is grossly outside the law.
May I say that it shouldn't be governed by whether the legality, it should be governed rather by morality.
Sure. And but ultimately, rules and laws are rooted in morality. Of course, the situation, the problem, the threat to our survival is so great that it was deemed necessary to bypass, to even ignore morality in order to address this. And it was done, they've tried to do it, you know, in the most morally acceptable way possible, which is why they've, from the very beginning, they've consulted with religious authorities. And the religious authorities have said, you know, in those secret conversations, that we will not accept any kind of we will not accept abortion, which is, you know, killing a fetus, killing a human being after conception, whether it's in the womb or not, whether it's you know, 2 weeks after conception or 4 weeks after conception or 3 months after conception. Religious authorities have always been dead set against abortion, right? So, but they have in secret allowed governments to prevent, to undermine fertility, so that, in other words, you prevent the birth of new people into the world, the birth of children, before the moment of conception. And this is done by undermining our fertility. And this is why this was the only way that was acceptable to religious authorities, and especially to the Catholic Church. And the sign that... that the Catholic Church, which was the, you know, the last remaining obstacle to the depopulation policy in the West, is evident in a in an encyclical letter published in 1969 by the Vatican. It is called Humanae Vitae, which means human life. And in this encyclical letter, there is one paragraph which betrays the fact that the Vatican has given its tacit go-ahead to secular authorities to poison our reproductive system in order to prevent the birth of children, so that we wouldn't have to resort to abortion, or at least that would be, you know, a point of last resort. It would be the exception rather than the rule. Whereas in China, where there were no religious obstacles to overcome, the government now prevents the birth of new children simply by aborting fetuses. That is done. Every Chinese woman has undergoes abortion once or twice in her lifetime. The numbers are there for everybody to see. They did not have to go behind people's backs and say, well, you know, we have moral impediments and we have legal impediments and democracy stands in the way, therefore, you know, we're going to proceed covertly. They could do it overtly by simply making a law saying that from now on everybody is allowed only one child. And but in so doing, they have overtly addressed the population problem, and they have not needed to subject their people to covert poisoning. So even though, you know, what is the greater moral crime here? To abort or to subject the entire human population to poisons that undermine the intellectual and genetic endowment of humanity? In other words, the damage you do in the long term by refusing to address this problem through legal, open ways is far greater than the damage that is done, you know, by aborting, by actually killing a fetus. The problem of overpopulation represents. It represents moral dilemmas that, however you cut it, whatever method you choose, you're going to have to confront, you know, very ugly realities. Whether it is abortion, if you do it openly, as the Chinese do, through the law, or whether it is, you know, damaging the genetic and intellectual endowment of the entire race, which is the end result of covert methods. What is the greater evil? They both methods, you know, both solutions entail a degree of evil, if you want. Unless people have the self-restraint, if you want, to ensure that they don't, you know, get pregnant, they don't have to resort to abortion. That, in other words, they use the natural cycles in order to prevent the natural fertility cycles in order to prevent impregnating women. So, and this is, of course, what the church has insisted on, especially the Catholic Church, you know, has insisted on as the only morally acceptable solution. But of course, it doesn't work because
I don't think the Catholic Church and the Vatican, which is responsible probably for more pedophilia than any other single organization on earth, can still crown themselves as the pinnacle of morality.
Well, that subject aside, the pedophilia, you know. Theoretically, yes, this is the only acceptable alternative. That is, you know, exercise self-restraint, only have sex during times when the woman is infertile, and so on. But in reality, in practice, it is not working because the sexual drive is so powerful that nobody can resist, and sure as hell, young people can't resist it. So,
well, maybe back in the day it was possible, but now we have 24-hour pornography to contend with. We have sexual videos and what. In fact, at the same time as the New World Order is encouraging people, whether by chemical or propagandistic means, to not have children, they are encouraging through the media and our current, I don't know, morally depraved society, I think would probably be an apt way to describe it, to have a propensity for sexual pleasure at any time, day or night. That's basically what it is. You've turned life into, instead of morality and responsibility, into amorality and sexuality being the domineering principles that are guiding our lives.
Well, you know, the sexually explicit nature of our society has also been socially engineered. And why? Because they realize that in order to if people are going to exercise self-restraint, that is to say, if they're going to have small families, they need to have sexual releases, you know, without resulting in pregnancy. So this is why I suspect pornography has been allowed, you know, to flourish, in order to provide people with the possibility of sexual release that does not result in pregnancy. That too is a consequence of the global depopulation policy, at least of its initial attempts to decide, you know, on what kind of methodology to employ or not to employ.
Is it not ironic that nowadays we're meeting somebody for the first night and having sex with them after taking home from the bar produces less children than a society previously where you had to wait till marriage before you could conceive?
Yeah, but that is so because our fertility is completely substandard. And the reason it is completely substandard is because we are being poisoned, chronically poisoned at low levels throughout the duration of our lifetimes from multiple sources, water, food, and so on, beverages. This is not because because we are using now condoms faithfully. It is because literally we are just not as fertile as we should be naturally. Now, to go back to the destruction of the rule of law and structural violence. Well, now obviously the global depopulation policy constitutes crimes against humanity and genocide, for better or worse. And this has made the administration of justice illegal and the authority of the state ill-gained. Why? Because the state, the very state that pretends to uphold the rule of law, subverts it in the most significant right, the right to life. So if while they're subverting our right to life, and our reproductive rights, they are pretending to maintain, you know, all of the other rights, including the right to life. So it is they're lying to our faces, and they have absolutely no justification, no legal justification, no legitimacy to be in control of the administration of justice, because they themselves violate justice in the most egregious manner, in the most fundamental right, which is the right to life. That is another paradox of our society. So, in other words, our Western societies now, through the covert methods of depopulation, are committing structural violence on a of a dimension hitherto unknown. This has never been this kind across the board crimes have never been committed before. Not even by the Nazis. Not even by Hitler. Who, you know, selected 7 million Jews and put them in concentration camps, but these 7 million Jews constituted a very, very small percentage of the population. Of course, what they've done to the Jewish people in the concentration camps during the Second World War and to the Gypsies is completely unthinkable today. But nevertheless, what is being done today to the entire spectrum of the population, to all of us, It is structural violence at an unprecedented level, although, of course, with a very, very small level of cruelty. So we've eliminated the cruelty, but the structural violence is greater than ever before.
It's perception management, more or less. If you don't know that you're a slave, you never lust for greater freedoms. And I think this is what the population has been conditioned into believing, is that slavery is freedom. And people who question the current slavery paradigm are crazy.
Well, it's not that, Vinny, it's not that the authorities don't want us to have as much freedom as we possibly can. But the reality is that any kind of social construct demands the abdication of absolute personal freedom for the common good, for collective interests.
May I say, there's two ways of actually looking at that. One is I abdicate my personal freedom for the greater good. Say, for example, I do this radio show for the greater good. I could have the freedom to go out and, I don't know, do some other kind of stuff instead. However, I'm not being forced to give up my freedom in order to do this. I am actually volunteering to give up my freedom without somebody telling me, because my morality compels me to do so. It is the moral obligation, I believe, that is a far superior form of servitude, because you impose it upon yourself for the right reasons to serve humanity, rather than somebody else taking it away from you for the wrong reasons.
Yes. And this is the solution to turning this thing around from covert methods to overt legislation. This is the solution. The truth has to be allowed to reign supreme. People have to know what the facts are, what the bitter realities are. And then, knowing the lack of choices, they will come, you know, to the only logical conclusion which we have to assume personal responsibility over this. We have to be in the driving seat of this depopulation policy. In other words, we have to control it, and we have to control it in our own bedrooms, in our own families, on a personal level.
Yeah. And there was a policy, I think, if you want to sustain, you need to plant three times as much as you cut down, kind of thing. I forget whose principle that was. It might have been Native Americans, I think, where they would cut down a tree in order to use the wood, but in so doing, they would always plant three seedlings per tree that they cut down. And as a result, the natural environment would always grow back just as much as they took, if not more. And nowadays, we plant nothing from what we take. And it's almost like the world is a microcosm of the Easter Island phenomenon, when there are no trees left.
Well, there has been a paradigm change, in the 1980s. And this paradigm change has resulted in documents and plans such as Agenda 21, which is, you know, completely vilified nowadays, and the Millennium Development Goals. But this is the reality of it. In order to rectify all of these, these combined problems that we have brought onto the world, we are paying for the sins of our fathers, if you want. We're paying for the sins of civilization. Now we've realized that we've reached the end of nature, and the only way to come back to a situation of where human civilization is in balance with nature is to solve these problems, to solve, you know, the problem of overconsumption, of overpopulation, and so on. And Agenda 21 and the Millennium Development Goals are the roadmap to solving these problems. And of course, it's bitter medicine. Everybody hates it because it's bitter medicine. It's very, very difficult to pay for your own sins, let alone for the sins of your fathers. And now we're paying for the sins of our fathers and our forefathers. But there is no other way. If we don't make this sacrifice, if our generation doesn't make this sacrifice, there will be no other generations after us. They will be left with a denuded world with absolutely no resources and no clean air to breathe, and they will be killing each other because there's going to be nothing left.
It reminds me, the term sacrifice, like, I think sacrifice is really only highly valued if it's self-sacrifice. Sacrificing everybody else because I want a society such and such and what have you, I think that's going in the wrong direction. It's forcing, I mean, like the Aztecs, for example, sacrificing people on top of a pyramid and throwing the headless bodies down the way. That's not like, oh, it's a moral, ethical sacrifice. You know, it's going to be good. It's going to be fabulous. Everybody's going to be happy because they're dead because we sacrificed them to our gods. Whereas self-sacrifice, people who actually go willing, people who behave selflessly, tends to have far greater effect. And indeed, it inspires self-sacrifice in others.
This is a very, very intelligent comment, Vinny. It's an extraordinarily intelligent comment, and I've come to the same conclusion. This is why I keep saying what we need is not a new global order. What we need is a new axial age. We need, you know, an awakening in our moral sentiment, in our a reawakening of our values, and we need to live in the image of God now more than ever before. I'm saying that, and I'm not even religious. You know, I've come to this conclusion as an agnostic. Why? Because the only way to make these sacrifices that we need to make for our children, for future generations, for the planet, the only way that we are going to accept paying for the sins of our fathers is if we have this humility that comes, you know, from our religious education. Religion has endowed us with this humility, the humility to make sacrifices for others, right? And society cannot thrive. And now we know better than ever before that society cannot exist, cannot continue unless human beings are willing to make this. And of course, religions in the past have inculcated those values in us. And now they're kind of dormant. You know, we have not used them. We've expected the system. We've expected the scientific fixes to solve what are primarily moral problems, to solve social problems. Social problems cannot be solved through scientific and technical fixes. They can merely be postponed, but they cannot be solved. And we have come to this realization. Actually, the science czar of Obama, of the Obama administration, his name is Dr. Holdren. You know, he has so much has said this. They have admitted this publicly now, which is the first time ever. And of course, without spelling out you know, the entire truth, they've said, you know, we cannot, science cannot fix our problems. Of course, you know, they did not say that science cannot fix our overpopulation problems, but this is what they meant. And now they're going, you know, from behind the scenes, from one government to another, looking for an alternative solution. And, of course, I have provided that alternative solution. It's called the Ohm Principles. But this alternative solution cannot happen unless people are energized and unless people embrace it and they make the necessary sacrifices, which requires self-sacrifice, which requires knowledge, which requires the truth. You know, there's going to be has to be a cascading effect. First, if you want to change this from covert to overt, from taking the responsibility from the hands of elites and governments and put it in the hands of the people, on people's shoulders and distribute it equally, people have to have the knowledge. In order to acquire the knowledge and the facts, they need to know the truth. And the truth is not being allowed out right now. You know, all our media outlets are designed and geared towards feeding us, you know, more lies and manufacturing consent in order to keep the illusion going keep the deception going, keep the con going. But they know, the people at the top, they realize that, you know, this con, this deception has worked for 68 years, but it's no longer possible. We can no longer continue with this because we're going to kill each other. You know, there's still this segment of the scientific community which believes that GMOs are going to solve all our problems. In other words, they're going to undermine our fertility without undermining our health. But that is another pipe dream, because we don't know. We just don't know what GMOs, what the long-term effect of genetically modified organisms will be. And I can guarantee you it's not going to be pretty. Because every time you interfere with a normal functioning of the human body, you're going to have negative side effects. That is a law of nature. It's just the way it is. The organism, the human organism, it is perfect the way it is, right? If you're going to try and shift this to there or undermine this, you're going to cause God knows, you know, what kind of repercussions within the normal functioning of the body. There's always going to be long-term effects when you start fiddling with a normal function of the body. Mm. And of course, the function to procreate is vital to the survival of the species. You know, so if you undermine the sexual, the reproductive system, you are doing extraordinary damage to the entire human body. That much is certain.
Mm.
It doesn't matter how you approach it.
Well, I liken this this kind of thing between the self-sacrifice and sacrifice that we were talking about before. It's kind of like you're in the kitchen and you're doing the dishes, and your child comes up and says, "You're doing the dishes wrong. You got to use more soap, or you got to scrub it better, or something of that nature." And then as a parent, you go, "How about this? You do the dishes." Right? If it ain't being done right, you've got to do it yourself. And that's precisely what the government avoids at every possible turn of doing it. Because if people learned that they could do everything themselves, they would be out of the job.
Yes.
And I said on Facebook the other day that a politician's job is not to solve problems. It is to create a crisis to facilitate their continued employment.
Well, no, in all fairness, Vinny, you know, this went underground, this policy went underground, and many of the policies that went along with globalization, which are intended ultimately to maintain international peace and to achieve universal prosperity, because there were structural and systemic obstacles that stood in the way. There were also cultural obstacles. There are also still religious obstacles that stand in the way. You know, it was not done with the intention to screw us. That's not the case. It has developed that way simply by the necessity to evade all of these obstacles, to find a way, you know, to go around all of these obstacles without having to confront them, because it was easier to go around them rather than confront them. And it's true. It was just simply not possible to approach it any other way in 1945, right? And in many ways today, in some conservative societies, it's still not possible today, which is why the secrecy is maintained.
Perhaps the reason why they came up with this in 1945 is because they'd just come out of World War II, a massive crisis, and mm-hmm. then once a crisis rears itself, you yeah. justify anything. Anything yeah. gets justified in the face of a crisis. Desperate times call for what?
Desperate measures. Yes, and it was a propitious environment. I mean, this is why they first tested these methods on the Axis powers and the losing powers, on Japan, Italy, and Germany, which is why, and I've discussed that, I think, in the last interview, which is why Germany, Japan, and Italy are the ones who have gone through the demographic transition first. Now they are the ones who have first reach a population pyramid which has more old people than they have young people. And that is why they have all of these, they're facing these economic problems the first, right? We are right behind them. We're going to face the exact same economic problems within 10, 15 years. The reason we're behind them is because, you know, our population is still growing. It's not decreasing yet due to immigration. But we are, you know, high immigration countries because we are in the New World, Canada, the United States, New Zealand, Australia. So we are about 15 years behind them. Japan was the first to reach, you know, the fourth stage of the demographic transition, where they have more old people than they have young people. Luckily, they have very high personal savings, but still, now they're running out of, you know, there's nobody to take care of the old. Germany is the second one with 24% old people and about the same number of same percentage of young people. Italy is the third one. So the Axis powers are the first to have reached stage level of the demographic transitions because they were first to have been subjected to covert methods of population control. And they were first subjected to this because there was no moral impediment. I mean, they were guinea pigs because they had lost the war, and now they're at the mercy of the Allied powers, and the Allied powers could impose whatever solutions they wanted on the losing powers, and that's exactly what they did. And yeah. Having tested them on the Axis powers, then they realized they worked really well. So then, in the early 1950s, they started employing them on their own people, as I described in my book, you know, in a tit for tat fashion, by between the communist camp and the capitalist camp. So you do one yeah. country, you do the other.
Yeah, it reminds me of a quote from Batman. I think it was The Dark Knight. It says, "You either die the good guy, or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain." And I think the Allied powers lived long enough to see themselves become the villain.
Yes, yes. And this is the difficulty and the burden of responsibility. Imagine. It is difficult to be the head of a family, a father. As a father, you have responsibilities, right? As a mayor, you have responsibilities towards the entire city. As a president or a prime minister, you have responsibility to an entire country, millions of people. But now the United Nations, which is there in charge, you know, of organizing, cooperating this global depopulation policy and the entire globalization process, they are responsible for the entire world, for 7 billion people. The burden of responsibility is so great that, you know, I would not want to be in the shoes of these people. And yet somebody has to have that responsibility. Somebody has to make decisions of life and death, of poverty and wealth, of illness and good health. That's how difficult it is. This is the burden of power, the burden of responsibility. There's no other way.
And ironically, none of those people who have unchecked power are using it responsibly. And I think that responsibility, that the pyramid has been inverted, okay? It's supposed to be lots of individual responsibility and then maybe a little bit of collective responsibility. It has now become virtually no individual responsibility and overarching, overwhelming collective responsibilities that are imposed upon us by others.
Yeah, but, you know, again, this has resulted because we have these humongous structures. In order to coordinate a plan of attack, if you want, globally, we've had to put together these global organizations, these structures that are mammoth bureaucracies. Well, mammoth bureaucracies like the United Nations and its agencies, you know, like the World Health Organization, like UNESCO and so on, like the United Nations Development Fund, who are in charge, you know, of one aspect of the globalization plan or another, are mammoth bureaucracies. A mammoth bureaucracy is very, very, very sluggish. It's very rigid. It's not reactive flexible like a single human being would be.
There's no diversity of decision-making processes. Yes.
But also because any kind of decision has to be done by consensus, okay? And to reach consensus in this huge bureaucracy between all of these players, these stakeholders, it's extremely difficult. It takes time. So any kind of decision takes time to make because you need consensus to make it, and then it takes time to diffuse it. It takes time to put it into action because you have to apportion, you know, all kinds of functions to the outer layers of the organization until it, you know, it percolates and perpetrates throughout society to accomplish the goal that was decided upon. So it is the size of the bureaucracies today that inhibit decision-making process, that make it also so apparently so inhumane. It's not because the will is not there to be humane. The will is there. I can guarantee you that. It's just that the ability, you know, to make these decisions on a global level and to apply them, to implement them on a global level, is so excruciatingly difficult. And they're working with broad strokes. They're working with macroeconomic tools, and of course, macroeconomic tools. It's like painting a corner with a 10-inch brush. It's going to be messy. It's going to be leaking all over the place, right? And people are going to suffer. You cannot be humane when you're working with macroeconomic tools, and that's all they have at their disposal. This is why, you know, the United Nations works from the top with their macroeconomic tools and this difficult process of consensus. And then from the bottom, we have the cleanup crew. And the cleanup crew, if you want, of all the mess, you know, of these macro tools are all the religious organizations, especially the Catholic Church, you know, with all of its hospitals and shelters and so on. Because so many people are forgotten, are left behind by these macroeconomic tools. And somebody has to, you know, to provide support from the bottom up. And this is where the Catholic Church has an extraordinarily important function to play. And, you know, love it or hate it. And now, of course, it's being attacked from every corner. They are the cleanup crew. They're doing the dirty work on the ground, you know. They are fixing all of the problems. They are wiping the tears, you know, of all of those who are forgotten and who have been brushed aside and who have been hurt and harmed.
Macroeconomic
tools.
Don't you find that ironic, though, is that the problem has been caused by a collectivist bureaucracy to which the Catholic Church is simply one of them, but it has different goals. However, the fact that it is, again, a collectivist bureaucracy means it will not actually ever solve the problem, and indeed it will continue to make all of those people who have been left out of the system, left out in the cold by the system, will never actually obtain anything independence, because it's either one form of collective bureaucracy that fails you or another form of collective bureaucracy that you're completely dependent on when the other one fails. And it means that people are never and shall never be independent at all.
Well, this is why having this understanding, having come to this understanding, to this wisdom, if you want, you know, through so many generations of social coexistence, now we know that we have to have these bureaucracies in place because we cannot coordinate these giant global plans. But at the same time, we have to give the individual a level of responsibility and flexibility so that he can be humane within these inhumane bureaucracies. And this is what my work now consists of, designing just that, you know, designing a political and an institutional structure that allows global coordination while at the same time allows personal responsibility and flexibility, so that we can wipe the tears of those who are being forgotten and run over by these macroeconomic tools. Mm. You know, we're learning. This is the very first time, and now this is why I'm going into politics now, because I think I have a contribution to make in this respect. And also because I'm you know, the very first one to be able to say all of these things. Everybody else is hiding the truth because they're afraid. They're afraid that if they come forward and they say this, they're not going to be elected, or they're going to lose their position within the system, or they're going to be punished. You know, they're not going to advance, or they're going to lose their employment altogether, and they're going to be starving to death, and their kids will have nothing.
Everybody's handicapped
by fear because personal responsibility has been robbed, has been taken away from us by these giant bureaucracies.
It's been done so systematically so that we didn't even notice. And then it's kind of like the Jefferson quote. He said, the bank should never have the power to issue the people's currency, because if they do, they will, through inflation and then deflation, deprive the people of their private property, and will one day they will all wake up homeless on the continent their forefathers conquered. And I think if we look at that not just in a banking sense, but in a personal responsibility or an individualistic freedom sense, we cannot allow international bureaucracies to determine what our freedoms can be, because via inflation and then deflation of their freedoms, they will wind up everybody being absolutely slaves in a world that their forefathers settled.
Well, this is why I say that you're very, very true in what you're saying, very right. This is why I say that to move forward into the future, we now have to divest, if you want, the elites of much authority simply by taking over many of the responsibilities so that we address those problems, you know, not from the top down, but from the bottom up.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
in order to do that, we need to educate the publics, and we need the truth to reign supreme. We need to be able to speak the truth. Because people, you know, it doesn't matter whether they are intellectually astute or not, they will get it. One way or another, they will get it. If they don't get it intellectually, they'll get it
emotionally.
Emotionally. They'll get it emotionally, exactly.
This wake-up process is a very emotional one indeed. I can't tell you how many nights I have virtually cried myself to sleep and felt this pain, this loss. It's like losing a loved one. Oh, I loved my collectivism. I loved my slavery because I was taught over my entire life to appreciate it and think that it was absolutely necessary, that I couldn't survive without it. And then you feel that loss. And you eventually have to learn that everything that you ever thought you would become, all of your life lessons and everything, you have to learn them all over again.
Yes, and you go through a tremendous sense of loss, but also to a tremendous amount of anger. And in order to get over the anger, you know, because you just want to kill people, you know, you want to kill everybody in power. That's your first reaction when you realize that, you know, you're at the end of all these cruel methods. But once you start to understand how this has come to be, that we are all victims of this, we're all trapped, you know, in this system, that you know, nobody can be blamed to the extent that we'll say, yeah, we're going to scapegoat that person or that person, you know, it's their fault. Because it doesn't matter who gets to a position of authority, we'll confront the exact same issues and we'll be limited to the exact same methods, unless the people take responsibility. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's going to be a tremendous awakening so that everything can be done, can be addressed, all these problems can be addressed from the bottom up and not just from the top down.
Indeed. Loss, then anger, and finally empowerment, ladies and gentlemen. Oh. This is the end of the second hour with my very special guest, Kevin Galilee, and we will be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Don't you go anywhere, folks.
Politician, can you make a right decision for all of us? For all of us, politician. Can you make a right decision for all of us? Yeah, for all of us. Politician, can you make a right decision for all of us? Yeah, for all of us. You can talk the talk, but will you walk the walk? Will you bring us comfort? Will you bring us comfort? You can talk the talk, but will you walk the walk, or will you bring us comfort? Or will you bring us comfort? Pale, 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 politician.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number three of the most thrilling 3 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts and then get subsequently exterminated. My very special guest is Kevin Galilee. He is the Deepak Chopra of genocide. He's Deepop Chopra. Welcome.
That's not an introduction. So we were talking about the direct consequences of the global depopulation policy, the political consequences. Since we have them nicely itemized. And I mentioned that governments are illegitimate and we have false democracies, for one thing, as a result of the depopulation policy. Two, that we have the rule of law has been subverted and there is structural violence on an unprecedented level. The third political consequence that I want to mention is the surveillance, censorship, and control society that has resulted as from the need to cover up the truth and to continue the deception. Now, of course, now we live in the digital age, and we have the ability to spread information faster and cheaper than ever before. So we can communicate across boundaries, across the oceans, at a dime's notice for no cost at all, just as we're doing right now. And with video. Now, in order for them to stifle the truth from coming to the surface at a time when we have this extraordinary ability to communicate, they have needed to put in place this system of surveillance, censorship, and control. And that is why we see all of these intrusions on our privacy. We see all of these intrusions on the communication that happens digitally, electronically, and they're listening in on everything because they are paranoid that the truth is going to come out and that there's going to be a global revolt, that the anger is going to be so great that people will not understand, will not have the time to understand. They will just react from the gut to the bad news. And if people don't have the time to understand what has happened, why we're in this mess, and they react by starting to, destroy, burning cars and destroy buildings, government buildings, and so on. If they lose control of society, it'll be impossible to regain it because it'll happen globally, because we are all at the receiving end of this policy. So that's why they have put together this system of surveillance, censorship, and control. They realize that this is coming to an end, but they need to maintain order until the depopulation policy can be retooled, until the covert methods can be abandoned and replaced by overt methods. And my guess is that the reason they're allowing me to speak and you to interview me is because we are the only ones who can tell the truth. So we are breaking the ice so that eventually they're going to, open the floodgates of the information highway. And before you know it, everybody in the media, everybody in the education system will be talking about this. Because only then can the population be educated at large, right? And there can be a change in policy. But right now, we are at the forefront of this. We are at the forefront of educating the public. They're listening to what we're doing. They're gauging, the success we're having. They're gauging the reaction of the audience. And I can guarantee you that the intelligence community knows more about me than I know about myself, probably. And they know more about you than you know about yourself. Why? Because we're so important. We're so extraordinarily important right now. We are at the forefront of change, of global change. If they see that we are successful in what we're doing, people are receptive to this, that people are willing to accept their responsibilities and do it so peacefully, right? Despite the difficult decisions that we're going to be asked, that we're going to be forced to make by circumstances, not by governments, by circumstances. They're gauging all of that. And if we're successful, this is going to go faster and faster. And the faster we convert this from covert to overt methods, the fewer people will suffer. The greater our chances for a bright future. The less the damage that our children will inherit from these methods of control.
Something you reminded me there of. Recruitment, how employers, they'll go to recruitment agencies and whatnot. Had a meeting with one of these recruiters one time, and he says, don't make decisions when you're depressed, especially yeah. about your employment and especially about your life, because you're not thinking clearly. And I remember one time when I went to work, I was looking after autistic children at the time, and I wasn't feeling very happy, and I was really upset and just wanted to quit that day. And I just remembered what he said, and I restrained myself. And I think this is precisely what needs to happen with everybody. Look, if you're hearing this information for the first time and it's depressing you and freaking you out and what have you, don't make important decisions in your life as yet until you have learned more, until you have processed the information. Okay, I know people who have only just woken up experience the same things as I did in the first year or two or three or however long it takes, where you go through that process of depression and then finally acceptance and then on through empowerment. You start making your decisions after you've gone through the trials of and tribulations, so that you actually know what you're dealing with, so that you can actually approach these challenges properly. Reserve judgment. Goodness, I define as the restraint of oneself from one's instincts in many cases. And evil, I define as the absolute lack of restraint from your morality.
Yes. How right you are, Vinny. I cannot even begin to express, you know, how much lies behind that that statement. How much evolution, you know, how much understanding, how much suffering, if you want. People cannot retrace that, you know, from the very few words, unless they go through this process themselves. This is a very painful process, a very long process. It really is a personal evolution from complete darkness to unbelievable light. And at the end of the tunnel, that sense of empowerment is there waiting for us. And it is absolutely priceless, because for the first time, not only will you have a sense of empowerment, but you will know exactly how the world functions. You will understand why these seemingly bizarre policies, you know, are happening. Why these seemingly ridiculous decisions are being made by our leadership? You will understand, and you realize that bind they're in, the dilemmas they're in, and that change is coming. Change on an unprecedented level for the better, and that what the end result of this change that is just around the corner is going to be a tremendous. Tremendously better society than we've ever had before. I'm 100% positive about that. I'm not at all negative about the future. The future is not bleak. There is absolutely every reason to be positive, because I know that we can do this. We can turn this around. If I can do it, this is my reasoning. If I can do it, coming out of nowhere, with absolutely out of complete ignorance, I had no clue at all how the world worked, even though I considered myself, you know, to be an open-minded person and paying attention to my environment and always asking questions. But until 2011, I had no clue how the world worked and what was behind all of the decision-making process, what was behind the international community and so on, and every, you know, conflict in the world and every decision at the high level. I had no clue. Now I know better than many of the politicians in power. What is happening? Why? Because I've had the time to analyze the situation, to understand it from the outside. But how? Not because I've had, you know, I've had access to secret information and documentation. No, because once you have a door, once a door opens to this knowledge, the knowledge of the matrix, if you want, right? You have time to explore it. You can simply reverse engineer. The thought process and the decision-making process of the leadership, simply by looking at it from the historical perspective, by considering all the obstacles that they would have encountered and so on. So it's very easy to retrace this process, to reverse engineer policy, if you want. This is what I have been doing. I have been reverse engineering policy the way, you know, let's say, an engineer would take apart an engine. Made by the Japanese, and you know, they say now I'm going to take it apart and draw the schematics, and I'll be able to do the exact same thing, even though I didn't have that knowledge before. This is exactly what I've done, but I didn't do this with a mechanical thing. You know, I've done this with policy, with the history of our world since 1945. And it's relatively easy to do. I'm not a genius, and yes, I am a bright person, and I have you know, the skills necessary to look at history and the analytical skills and the curiosity, if you want, to find solutions to questions. But if I can do it, anybody can do it. I'm no Einstein. So there is definitely hope, and we're looking forward to some absolutely wonderful things, I think, in the next 10 years and beyond.
It's faith, I think, to a large degree. You know, having faith that things will be better, having faith in humanity and what have you. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm starting to adopt and see many religious principles that I've observed to have inherent truth within them, and hence adopted those principles whilst discarding about 98% of the religion itself. And as a result, I think I've actually gained a spiritual awareness and a faith that has served me well, not a faith in my government, nor a faith in necessarily a higher spirit, but faith in myself and faith in humanity. And the good thing about faith is that it matters not how many people try to discourage you from having it, because it has a religious zealotry attached to it that cannot be overcome by oppression or depression.
Yes, it gives you an individual strength that is...
It's beyond yourself. It's beyond yourself, more or less.
The source is beyond. Yes, it's not rooted in society and in the opinion of others. It has a much deeper root than that.
Yeah, it's like in an example I use many times to illustrate this point is the POWs in Vietnam and their survival rates. They had a very, very low survival rate. Prisoners of war did, had they no faith in God. Yeah. Those who had extraordinarily high religious values, Christians and so on and so forth, invariably survived the camps. Because when they were locked alone in their cell with no hope of escape, they weren't alone and they weren't without hope.
And now, you know, I've experienced this personally, because I have been imprisoned 6 times. And the last time, I spent 9 months in jail. And I'm also now remembering, you know, my father's observations. My father, who was a medical doctor and who took on the communists in Romania, he was imprisoned for 4.5 years, almost 5 years. And he said the exact same thing, that the that his cellmates who were religious, you know, they fared way better than anybody else because of the strength that the faith gave them. And had I not had this faith, you know, in humanity, as you say, had I not had faith in myself and faith in the inherent goodness of humankind, I would have not come out of this unscathed. You know, I would have long fallen apart, whether it's, you know, mentally or emotionally, in whatever way, because they've tried to undermine me in every possible way in order to deter me from following, you know, this to the end, right? But I've made such good use of all of these lessons that religions have to teach us, in order to get over this terrible time of imprisonment and you know, dealing with this disappointing news, this terrible news. And I've even though I'm not religious and never considered myself religious, you know, I've never realized that all of these values were deep within me, inculcated by the culture, not necessarily by my attendance to church, because I've never attended church, other than, you know, going to Christmas ceremonies and Easter. But they were there nevertheless. And for instance, one of the Christian lessons, and I've reached out not just to the lessons of Christianity, but also to the lessons of Buddhism, to the lessons of Hinduism, and so on. For instance, lessons of Christianity that have helped me through this. The notion of turning the other cheek, you know, forgiving your enemy, loving your enemy, despite of what they have done to you. If I had not had these lessons, these wisdoms to reach out to, I would have self-destructed in jail simply because the anger that I felt at the authorities, right, of imprisoning me for nothing, for being a decent human being, basically, would have eaten me alive, and I would have come out of there, you know, ready to kill, murder, and maim in retaliation. But these Christian values have allowed me to turn that anger into a constructive direction, and to use it, you know, to understand and to retrace the path that the world has taken since 1945. To turn that into love rather than hate. I could not have done this without the lessons of Christianity, and I'm deeply grateful for that. Another thing, had I not had yoga skills, which I learned in India and by practicing yoga, which is a Hindu offshoot, I would have not survived. Why? Because yoga has allowed me to go deep inside myself, especially during the 75-day hunger strike, which is the longest hunger strike in Canadian prison history that I have done. And I've done it as a 47-year-old. I'm not young anymore, right? It's a miracle I survived 75 days of hunger strike. And the only reason I survived that is because I could go into meditation, deep meditation, and I could calm myself and almost slow down the level of energy needed for my body to function, I guess. Somehow this happened, and I was meditating, for hours throughout the day during the hunger strike. 75 days, there have been 75 days of meditation, basically, of yoga. Had I not had that skill, that ability to go inside of myself and to find that peace, that serenity, which yoga and Hinduism has given to the world as a gift, I would have not survived. Certainly would have not survived 75 days of hunger strike. This is almost physically impossible, right? During those 75 days, for the audience who doesn't know, I've lost 55 kilograms, or 28% of my body weight. And I've lost that, in 75 days as a 47-year-old man. Well, people are not aware with what this actually means. This is an incredible thing. This is almost medically unexplainable. This has happened not because my physical strength is so extraordinary, even though I have, I'm a strong person, I'm a healthy person, but it's because I had this, I had the ability to reach into this fountain of strength, which is faith. In something greater than ourselves, and faith in the goodness of mankind, and faith that there's going to be light at the end of the tunnel, and faith that I'm going to prevail, that I'm going to turn a global policy around, with the help of people like you, because I cannot do this alone. I can be a spark, as you are, a spark. But, if this spark has to spread, otherwise it is going nowhere. It's just going to die with us.
We are the spark, and the audience is the breeze that fans the flames. It may engulf the entire world in freedom and faith and love and honor and dignity and respect, moral obligations, that kind of thing. Now, I've got this this idea that basically, for lack of a better term, I'm more or less a religious figure now. I stand up against religions and what have you. And I remember as you were speaking, something that occurred to me. A pastor once told me, don't go to church. Jesus never went to church except to mess up the place.
Well, that's right. Because, we have an inherent need for reaching towards the divine, if you want, for higher ideals, religion has nurtured them, has sort of shown the path, if you want, they're like textbooks, for following this path of inner discovery, but they're not absolutely necessary by any means. And I had this conversation, in jail with the pastors, and because every now and then, once a week, we would have a visiting pastor to talk to us. And I was getting into huge arguments with him, saying that, he was a Christian, and he said that the only way to God is through Christ. And I said, no, there are 7 billion people on earth, and there are 7 billion ways to God. And every one of us has to find his own way to God. No one religion monopolizes the key to the kingdom of God, the key to this ultimate knowledge of self and the greater universe. These are just, they're just well-trodden avenues opened by others. Religions provide, an easier way to find your way, but you can find your own way.
Kind of like a road. The Romans built a whole lot of roads, and it made it very easy to find the way, but it also made it very easy for the Romans to project military dominance over your life.
Yes, everything is a double-edged sword, isn't it? Including faith. This is why it's being used and misused. Right?
It's being used as a weapon.
Could you
imagine the callous, malicious nature of a human being who would decide to use the best part of people's cells as a weapon?
But the same is happening not just with faith, not just with religion, but also with science. Science, scientific tools, scientific methods are being used to undermine our health, to undermine our existence. I mean, you know, this is the thing. Everything has this duality, this potential for good and evil, and the trick, if you want, the secret in life is to find that balance, that perfect point of harmony between the two, and we have to find that ourselves. Nobody can find it for ourselves.
That's
just like,
right.
Like nobody else can chew your own food. You have to chew your own food.
And that reminded me of a microwave beams. One dude invented a microwave beam that you could shoot it at salt water and it would start boiling. And so he realized, oh my God, I can use salt water as fuel. And he made a car that ran on it and it was running perfectly fine and well. And at the same time, the U.S. military was pioneering a form of microwave tank where you could shoot microwaves at the enemy soldiers and they would explode from within.
Yeah, well, the perfect example is, you know, the nuclear energy. You can use it to produce energy to advance civilization and heat homes and so on, or you can use it for the ultimate destruction, you know, the nuclear annihilation of an atomic explosion. It's either way.
Incidentally, even when you try to use that nuclear energy for the good purposes, one tsunami can turn it into a bigger nuclear weapon than anything you can manufacture.
Yes. But, you know, life is difficult. We, throughout our existence, we've struggled against all odds, if you want, to make progress for civilization to advance. You know, it has taken the combined effort of billions of people before us and billions of people today. And we are all, but this is the thing, the human race, the human being is inherently good, and all of us aspire to have a positive influence in the world. It is just that circumstances sometimes do not provide us with the possibility to do good. We're sometimes forced, you know, cornered, if you want, to react in negative ways. And that is why it is so important that the system, especially this global system that is in the process of coming upon us, you know, as the form of government for the future. That is why it is so important that it is properly conceived, that we have a say in it, and that it embodies the best in us. That is to say, our highest common denominators, not forcing us to settle for our lowest common denominators, which is what is happening, right? Because of the difficulty of agreeing, you know, on a course of action, and the difficulty of implementing tough decisions, we have settled, or the international system that we have now has settled upon the lowest common denominators. And the global depopulation policy is the perfect embodiment of that, because it is the lowest of the low. And only we can turn that around. You know, our leaders cannot do that for us. They've tried their best, and this is all they could come up with. And now it is, if we want better, then we have to take control of this, and we have to show them that it is possible to do better. And the only way it is possible to do it better is if we all share responsibility. It's as simple as that, and as hard as that.
Well, the element that I think really ties into this is psychopathy. Psychopaths do not think like you or I. You kind of think, why would somebody do that? Why would somebody lie so terribly? Why would somebody rape and kill and murder and pillage and destroy and steal and all of that kind of stuff and not feel bad about it in any way, ever? Why would they always sabotage their competition in order to advance themselves forward? Why would they kill and torture little babies? Why would they wear a teenage girl's head as a hat as he drives through three states and what have you? Somebody with a conscience and any form of morality would not be capable of understanding that, because they're not insane psychopaths. Now, what I find very interesting is the American Medical Journal defined a psychopath as a person very nice and friendly and smiley when you first meet them, but ultimately has no depth to their character and doesn't give a frack about anybody but themselves.
No empathy.
And they tend to cluster, and these are the only two desires of psychopaths so far as I know, and it's power and control. All right, those are their two desires. And they fear two things, being exposed and being threatened by even worse psychopaths than themselves. Now, the American Medical Journal goes on to state that the likely industries where these people are to cluster in is the centers of power and control. Business, entertainment, politics, law, medicine, and religion. What would you say, Kevin, are the institutions that have managed to implement this global control system, this global depopulation agenda, and all the world wars, and all the international finance, and everything thus far? Be all of those all racked together. And it becomes clear now why the world seems like such a crazy place. It's because crazy people are in charge of it.
And yet, the people who meet this description, this psychological description, are few and far between us. They're the exception, not the rule. The normal people are the overwhelming majority. Mm-hmm. And it is up to us, to the overwhelming majority of normal people, to take responsibility and to make sure that we not allow, psychopaths or those with such traits or psychopathic policies to dictate our life. Mm. And that is entirely in our hands. Because let's face it, the few psychopaths that have made it to positions of power could very easily be disabled by us if we only stood up and took our civic duties seriously, and if we took responsibility seriously, and if we're willing to make sacrifices for the common good and not just for ourselves. It is all within our hands. If we allow ourselves to be victims of a few psychopaths, then we deserve to be victims of a few psychopaths, because simply we're not better. We don't deserve any better. Mm. And I'm very, of course, ever since I've started speaking, about these inconvenient truths, I've been very disappointed, of course, that people have not immediately come to the realization of the importance of what I'm talking about, that it is of existential importance to everybody, that there's absolutely nothing out there in the world that is more important. It's puzzled me that people haven't simply stopped everything they're doing to take this cause upon themselves and to change this immediately. It has been of a great befuddlement to me that these news have not spread like wildfire. That 2 years later, I'm still, trying to gain momentum, if you want, and to create a tidal wave that will be irreversible.
You're never a prophet in your own home nor your own nation, are you?
Yes, that's true. It seems, at least among some people, it seems that they have a more difficulty to accept one of their own as, doing something extraordinary than to accept that somebody far away is capable of something extraordinary.
I think that's because if it's one of your own that's doing something extraordinary, it makes you feel guilty because you know that you're capable and you're falling short yourself. And so therefore you need to tear down everybody around you that is putting you to shame.
Yes, I'm certain that you are right in your analysis. But nevertheless, we are all capable of extraordinary things, and this is the amazing thing: is that now, perhaps for the first time in history, we're being called, we're being asked by circumstances to rise to the occasion and do extraordinary things. And if we don't, we're all screwed. We're being provided with the opportunity, but also with the duty, because there are no two ways about this. If we turn our back on this, we're all lost. That's the end of it. If we turn our back on this, it's the end of it, because the people in power, psychopaths or not, whether it's, they're doing these cruel things because they're psychopaths or because they're constrained by the inadequate tools that they have and by the necessity of reaching consensus among 7 billion people and imposing, decisions from the very top by a handful of people on 7 billion people. However you want to analyze this, from whatever angle you want to look at it, whether it's from the positive or the negative point of view, the point is that it can only be turned around if we take control, if we rise to the occasion and we do extraordinary things. And one of the extraordinary things that we have to do, that our generation has to do, is we have to marry, for the first time, we have to marry within us science and faith. In other words, we have to think, you know, rationally, but yet have the courage that can only come from faith, the courage to take a leap of faith. And it's not called a leap of faith for nothing. It is called a leap of faith because we're going to the unknown. And unless we have that courage, that crazy courage that comes from faith, we're not going to be able to trust ourselves and to believe in ourselves to the degree that we feel we're capable of shaping global policy and of being in control of the world.
Mm.
We won't do that. It only comes from...
Oh, sorry, continue.
So we have to marry reason and faith. No yeah. other generation in the past has had to do that. There's always been a struggle, you know, throughout history between reason and faith, if you want. During the Roman times, you could say that reason prevailed. During the medieval times, you could say that faith prevailed. But if one proceeds without the other, only disaster waits at the end of the road. We see what has happened, you know, with the Inquisition throughout Europe. You could say that is faith at its worst, or faith unrestrained by reason. Now we can see what reason, in the form of science, has done without faith. It has subjected us to population control methods, to poisoning, to eugenics, to genocide, to a society of absolute control, and so on. So unless we are capable and we succeed in marrying faith with reason, we're all lost. And this balance has come, you know, from centuries of trial and error. This understanding, this wisdom, has come from centuries of trial and error. Now, for the first time, we understand that one, that our future cannot be bright, that it's not possible to be human and humane without being capable of marrying faith and reason, you know, within our own consciences, within our own actions, because our own actions will dictate the ultimate outcome, the sum total of society. And if we behave, you know, properly as individuals, and if we do our part, then the end effect, the sum total of our society is going to be good. If we don't, if we refrain from doing our part, if we hide, you know, behind our walls, behind the walls of our own homes, and fail to do our duties towards society at large, then we're going to be all lost.
Yeah. Well, I think what's happening now as society is that we need to expel these things that we no longer want and just take a risk, you know? It's kind of like if you're really, really drunk and you can't find the light switch and you've got to go to the bathroom to take a wiki leak in pitch black darkness, you're just taking a leak of faith.
Yes. It's a good analogy. You're always very inventive in coming up with great analogies. I wish I had your inventiveness.
I put the anal in analogy.
Okay, let me go back to the list. So I finished the political consequences, if you want, direct consequences of the global depopulation policy. Let me move on to the ethical. And the first one at the top of the list is that we have a culture of deception, dishonesty, and cruelty as a result of this. Now, whether they like it or not, governments nowadays have to lie to their people and to deceive them into believing this false reality, right? Which is an illusion manufactured to hide these dangerous truths of the depopulation policy. So you have lies built upon lies. We are told that fluoride is good for our teeth, that chemtrails are meant to slow down global warming, that the GMOs will increase yields and feed the starving, that plastic is safe, that flu vaccines will save the sick and the old from dying, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, that 9/11 was the work of Islamic fundamentalists, that affluence stops overpopulation. All of these things are complete lies, so that they could proceed, you know, while distracting us, they could proceed with the plan. They could sort of force us towards this direction, which is our you know, the ultimate goals are fantastic. They're noble goals. Global peace and universal prosperity are noble goals. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the goals. It's just the methods, the methodology to reach these goals are wrong. They're completely wrong. So we have a culture of deception, dishonesty, and cruelty. That is one of the ethical consequences of this.
A culture of scumbaggery.
Scumbaggery, yes, that's another way of not putting it. What else do we have? Another consequence is that we have a warped media, completely dysfunctional media, which instead of educating the public and informing the public, the mainstream media's role is to misinform and to indoctrinate. So deception, dissimulation have proliferated alongside this increasing monopolization of the media by a few giant corporations. And the reason they've monopolized the media in the hands of a few giant corporations is so that they could have ultimate control. They could have, you know, tight control of the message. If they can control the message, they can stifle the truth. And if they can stifle the truth, they can continue, you know, with these methods that are based on deception and lies. That is coming to an end. You know, it's coming to an end because of people like you, who have the courage to stand there and who instead of going out and drinking and having fun, you know, you are spending your energy on educating the public at great risk to yourself. And of course, you know very well at the beginning, we've been ridiculed. We've been, obviously, shills have come from the woodworks, you know, to accuse us of this, that, and the other, to disillusion us, to frighten us, to bully us, and so on.
I'm not entirely certain if what I'm doing puts me at great risk. I think that doing nothing would put me and everybody at even greater risk.
This is the way I saw it, you know, and this is when I realized what is at stake. I realized that whether I do something or I do nothing, the risk is the same. At least if I do something, I have a chance of not only taking control of this and of having a say in the outcome, but at least I'm in control of my own destiny. At least I regain, you know, the dignity of man, dignity of life, and I'm not a slave to a system. I'm not a slave to, you know, other people's decisions.
It's exactly like at the very end of The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, where they've got bugger all army left or anything like that, but they have to march on the Black Gate in order to distract the armies of Sauron so that the Hobbit can have his chance to chuck the ring in the mountain, right? And the dwarf says, "Certainty of death! Small chance of success! What are we waiting for?"
Yes. And also, what kind of man would I be if I don't defend my children? If I don't defend the integrity of my children's minds and bodies? What kind of man would I be if I didn't defend my family? I would be a rat, not a man. And it puzzles me that so many so-called men, you know, that men out there are not standing up and acting as men, and instead they're behaving as rats, you know, waiting for other men to fight the good fight so that they can have all the benefits, but without lifting a finger. And what this is, it has come to a point now that where, you know, we're all being tested. And if we don't rise to the occasion as men, as human beings, we're all going to fail. Because this is not something that can be turned around by a single man. This is a global problem that can only be solved through global effort. A single man, you know, like you and I, despite our most valiant efforts and achieving extraordinary things and, you know, fighting the system to break the ice, we can only take this so far. Yeah. Without everybody standing up, nothing is going to happen.
The best we can hope to be is an example to others, you know.
Because I cannot moderate and regulate, you know, people's moral behavior and decisions in their lives. Everybody has to do that on their own, so that the end effect, the sum total of our society is going to be positive, not negative. All we can do is, you know, show the way and inspire others. But if men don't have the courage and the integrity to stand up and defend their families and their children, then they don't deserve to make it into the future. That's the reality of it. Mm. And this is where, you know, you start to think like the depopulationists, because they are giving us the opportunity to rise to the occasion. But, you know, very few people are rising to the occasion. Very few people have the courage to face the facts. Very few people have the energy to follow the facts, their ultimate source, and so on. So, you know,
it reminds me of it reminds me of a couple of things the Founding Fathers were saying is if you give up your freedom for security, you lose both and deserve neither. What was the other one? In the beginning, a patriot is scorned, insulted, and cast out of his society. And only once his cause has proved successful do others join it, because then it costs nothing to be a patriot.
Mm. Yeah. Yes. No doubt. now I don't want to go through the medical consequences, which are direct consequences, simply because they're quite well known. You know, irreversible infertility, general ill health, downgraded genetic and intellectual endowments, endemic mental and developmental illnesses, sexual confusion, and so on. We've talked these issues to death. They're out there, you know, for everybody to grasp if only they want to. But I want to talk about the indirect consequences now. Because the indirect consequences are not as clear, and people don't realize what is at stake unless they are introduced, you know, to these indirect consequences, and these consequences are explained to them. Now, going from a growing to a decreasing population causes economic havoc in liberal free market economies that are premised on continuous growth. Capitalism, as you well know, is premised on growth. Well, you cannot have growth in a decreasing population. And now that we have reached the fourth stage of the demographic transition, the populations have started to decrease throughout the Western world. Japan was the first, right? Germany, Italy. And now basically every European country now is decreasing in population. So one of the most obvious consequences of this is recession, deflation, chronic unemployment. So all of the economic ills that the governments now are fighting so hard to address. Well, a stable and especially a decreasing population brings about stagnation and respectively contraction in consumer spending, which in turn causes recession. And that if prolonged, if it goes on and on, it results in chronic unemployment, deflates the value of goods and services as there is more supply and demand, and you have a chain effect of a spiraling downward economic situation. And this is what is happening now. We see that, you know, throughout Europe, all of the social systems are collapsing. The economic symptoms that I described, you know, are the most acute in Japan, as would be expected, because they are the first to have reached this fourth stage of the demographic transition, and of course Europe is right behind it. And before you know it, the U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand will enter the exact same deflationary spiral, recessionary spiral, chronic unemployment spiral, and that is going to be impossible to address until the population stabilizes.
Or unless the population gets orderly exterminated.
That's not going to happen. You know, there's no way they're going to succeed in that. So there is another unless. The other unless
are you sure? Because I've yes. seen a lot of biological nutrient technologies. There's something like 1,000 plus bioweapons labs in the United States. They've got the chemtrails and everything like that. If they wanted to wipe everybody out, they could do it without a moment's notice.
Yes, there's no doubt about it. They could do it. It is, you know, it's possible. They have the tools to do it. But nobody wants this outcome. You understand?
Unless they're psychopaths, insane psychopaths who have their finger on the trigger. This is what my concern is. I'm sorry. Yeah, continue.
The few psychopaths that are part of these inner circles are constrained by the others. Nobody has ultimate authority in today's system. There's a check of and balance of power. Politicians are constrained by bankers. Bankers are constrained by politicians. Politicians and bankers are constrained by policymakers and by technocrats and by experts in their various fields of knowledge. Mm-hmm. This is such a complex system with so many layers of responsibility that no single person has the authority or the ability, you know, to push the red button and terminate humanity. That's not going to happen. And even, you know, let's say that we have, in the unlikely event that we have a group of psychopaths all having gained control of the ultimate control of the world, even they would realize that it would be to their own demise if they were to destroy the entire humanity. The psychopaths have to be able to benefit from other people's labor and from other people's struggles and so on.
However, one of the elements of psychopathic mentality is a lack of an awareness for the consequences of their actions.
Well, I'd say more a lack of compassion, you know, and empathy for the pain or suffering caused to others. But I'm sure that they would know their own interest. You know, people who don't know their own interest simply do not survive. And the fact that we know our own interest has evolved, you know, from a process of evolution. And those people who are most likely to know what their own interest is and to make the right decisions will survive into the future, and their genetic lines will prosper. Whereas the others, those who can't make these decisions, you know, will go into oblivion. So I'm not concerned at all that a group of psychopaths is going to kill us all. No, I'm not. What I am concerned about is that they will, you know, the international community will realize that they cannot, that all of these systems and measures in place right now to stop the population explosion, to a peak at 9 billion by 2040 or 2050, which is the goal now, the second phase of the population policy. If they realize that they cannot succeed that, in doing that, in accomplishing this goal, and they see that our food supplies are dwindling and that we're approaching such a critical situation that unless they do something preemptively, we're all going to be dead, or they're going to lose control, there's going to be havoc, or there's going to be a run for whatever little food there is left, then they might have some conceivably a plan B where they would preemptively, call a certain percentage of the population in order to prevent this collapse from dire necessity. That's conceivable. I'm not saying it is impossible, but even then, I believe that before we come to, you know, to such dire point, we will have long succeeded in turning this around by simply educating the public and by simply realizing that we're all in this together. And that concerted action is necessary, and is necessary from the bottom up, coordinated at the same time with action from the top down. I think we've already broken the ice. We've already done, you know, the most important part. That is to say, we have come to this realization, and now it's just a matter of spreading this wisdom, you know, to everybody else, so that everybody else can come to this realization. And I think that is a doable thing. We can accomplish this, but we won't come to, we won't give the authorities the opportunity to resort to Plan B, that is, to the desperate plan of preempting a societal or civilizational collapse.
As we mentioned in the previous segment about how desperate times call for desperate measures, I have my reservations about what it is that I'm doing, trying to wake people up. I mean, we've talked much during this broadcast about unintended consequences. Yes. What if what we are doing right now actually winds up in future being found out to be very detrimental to the entire human race? What if we're unwittingly, unknowingly, through trying to do good, actually accomplishing even worse things? Yeah.
And that is exactly what has happened. We've come to the understanding that by trying to do something, you know, good for humanity, but in secret, through, you know, deceptive methods, we've done tremendous damage to the intellectual and genetic endowment of humanity. We've already come to that realization. That's why we're allowed to speak now. This is one of the intended consequences. And I've just lost you here. Oh, there we go. You're back. But, you know, this is a fluid situation, and people are continuously analyzing what is the best way and sort of readjusting, you know, the direction of this policy. Now we're going through a complete turn of the ship. I believe that the decision has already been made. That is, they want a change from covert to overt methods of population control. They realize that it's necessary, that there's no other way, right? So the decision having been made, now it's just a matter of turning the ship around. That is to say, they have to retool, you know, to redirect this huge infrastructure that has been put in place for the past 68 years to accomplish now these goals through a different methodology. This is not an easy task. This is going to take time. And plus, they're also constrained by the fact that they have to do this gradually to allow people, you know, the time to get over the anger, to get through the process of reaching, you know, the point of empowerment through this knowledge, because that takes time, instead of, you know, overreacting and going on a rampage, on a destructive spree of rage.
Mm. A new religion has popped up. It's called the New Age religion, whose principal ideology is solipsism. Nothing is real. Nothing exists. There's no objective truth. There's no good. There's no evil. And ultimate acceptance of everything around you is simply an experience, and never, ever trying to change things for the better because you believe that you can't, that nothing is real, right?
That's just simply, you know, people who are demoralized and who just have thrown their hands into the air and said, there's nothing I can do about this, you know, and just forget about it.
I give up. I'm going to be New Age now.
Yes. This is the give up crowd, right? I don't belong to the give up crowd. Never will, because if you come to that point, then you would. What's the point of living? Then you might as well put a bullet in your head and just you know, stop consuming precious resources. If you come,
do
to
you
that
believe point. That all of these people? Remember how we talked about faith and how you learned a lot of lessons about it while you were incarcerated. Do you believe that all of these people who believe in that solipsistic viewpoint have no faith? That when the chips are down for them, they will be the one that dies in captivity.
Yeah, I'm certain that you know, that's one of the things that they lack. But the faith is something; it's not something that you cannot get. You can nurture that, right? And oftentimes you find faith in the most dire circumstances, when there's nothing else left to reach for. That's when you find faith. When you come to a point where, you know, you can no longer rely on materialism, you can no longer rely on the system or on others, you know, around you. So then you reach to faith. It's the last straw, if you want. So oftentimes we find faith in the least likely places, or in the most unpropitious places, which is why my faith was strengthened, you know, in jail. And you'll find that, you know, anybody who has spent time in prison, they'll tell you that everybody finds God in prison. It's true. Everybody finds God in prison. It's
not a choice. It's a lack of options.
Yes, it's a lack of options. And it gives you such tremendous strength, you know, and tremendous hope when there's none to be had. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot to be said for that.
All right.
The unintended consequences. I mean, we're running out of time. How much time do we have left?
A couple of minutes. We can go as long as you like, but wrapping it up fairly soon would be a good idea.
I'm just going to mention them quickly then, without elaborating. So, universal loss of freedom and a global police state. This is one of the unintended consequences. It's not because it was planned that way. You know, having had to cover up the lie, and pursue with this plan, you know, despite popular resistance to it, they have imposed basically police state controls. That's one of the unintended consequences. Countries as prisons, or this concentration camp mentality, has evolved now. Why? Because they're so paranoid about losing control that you know, they in order to keep control, they have to consider countries, you know, like basically major. Huge prisons, and treat, you know, citizens like prisoners, if you want, by curtailing our rights, so that we don't go overboard. One of the long-term consequences of this, which is, you know, looking generations into the future, is that if this continues, there's going to be a devolution or a splicing of the species. That is, it's, you know, the people who are able to protect themselves, the insiders of this global policy, they will have you know, good health and an unadulterated mind. So their offspring are going to be continue, you know, on this path of evolution. They're going to be smarter and, you know, taller and better. Whereas the rest of us who are subjected to these poisons in the environment for generations, over multiple generations, are going to devolve into a retarded and feeble human race. And this was foreseen by an evolutionary scientist, and I forget his name right now, but he published an article about that. But of course, I think long before we come to that, the so-called enfeebled ones, or the ones in the majority exposed to population control methods, will simply not be able to procreate. They won't even have any offspring, you know, enfeebled or not.
You know what you're telling me there is almost word for word precisely the goal of hardcore eugenicists.
Yeah, they want to make eugenics a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, by lowering the genetic and intellectual standards of a great proportion of the population, they'll say that they'll be able to justify to themselves, you know, the ultimate annihilation of this segment of society by saying, well, they are almost subhuman. You know, why would you want them to survive into the future? Yeah. They're just a burden on society, right? They're not capable of civilized behavior. They don't have the mental aptitude to master, you know, the scientific and technological tools necessary for a modern society. So it's self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah,
you know, they lower our intelligence and they say, "Well, you know, you're just not capable. You're not fit for modern living. You just, you know, you're a subhuman."
This is the law of nature, so I'm going to artificially impose it.
Yes, you can look at it that way.
And they call us retarded.
As I said, the plan has never been this. You know, this has not been driven by eugenic. Now I'm convinced of that. Has not been driven by, you know, hidden eugenic objectives. It's just that the methodology has allowed, you know, kind of eugenic trait or eugenic consequences to this sort of genocidal population control policy. But I'm not going to go any further into that, because I want to wrap it up by putting the global depopulation policy in the greater context of the globalization, or the you know, the decision at the end of the Second World War to create a peace globe that is where peace reigns supreme and affluence is universal. In order to do that, the international community has had to achieve three goals. One is economic integration. The other one is political centralization, and the third one is demographic transition. So the global depopulation policy is accomplishing this third goal, which is a demographic transition. Why? Because you cannot have you know, exponential growth of the population on a limited planet with limited resources. Sooner or later, something's got to give, and you would have to go in reverse in order to live within the means of the planet, within the existing natural resources. It's very simple. It doesn't take, you know, a genius to realize that. And history has had offers, you know, multiple examples where civilizations, minor civilizations like the Mycenaeans and the people on Easter Island, have outgrown their resources and have died out, or at least their civilization came to a collapse. But the other two goals, economic integration and political centralization, are, you know, part and parcel of this this positive plan, this noble plan to unite the world in common purpose. And of course, economic integration cannot happen without bringing the global population to a similar standard of living, similar income. So they're aiming now towards what I call a zone of convergence. That is to say, they want, you know, the rich world to lower their standard of living and their consumption level. So they are impoverishing the rich world, if you want.
Well, with the exception of the super rich population.
Well, I explained that why that is necessary, why they're concentrating money in very few hands. Because by concentrating money in very few hands, you know, those billionaires can take that capital and shift it from the developed world to the developing world in productive facilities, manufacturing, and so on. So they're shifting capital, know-how, and productive facilities to the developing world, And in so doing, they're impoverishing or bringing down the standard of living in the developed world while raising the standard of living in the developing world. So they're achieving this point of convergence. Like, we're going down and the poor are going up, so that we know we're going to come together eventually.
And we'll all meet together at the very bottom with the elite on the top who don't have to give up anything.
There's no doubt, and now we're going towards the bottom. That is to say, we're all getting poor. Why? Because we have to share our limited resources among 7 billion people. So we are now sharing a decreasing pie. Once the population stops growing and starts shrinking, we are going to be sharing an increasing pie. So the sharing is going to be that much easier. So this is the goal of economic integration. But the second goal, the political centralization, is necessary because we're moving now from a world which is ordered according to national interests and national institutions towards a world that is ordered according to international or global interests and global institutions. This is the greatest transition in human history. We're now moving towards the greatest social organization or social construct in human history. For the first time in human history, we are encompassing the entire world. We are uniting across continental frontiers, across man-made boundaries and natural boundaries. Now, this is a goal that has existed in the human race for thousands of years, and others have attempted to accomplish it in the past through military conquest, and they have failed. And now this is being done through monetary coercion. This is why the power of money is so important. This is why banks and the economic system has such an important role to play. And this is why we all have loved to hate it, right? Because all of the goals towards unity, towards economic unity, political unity, and so forth, they're being pursued through the power of money, through economic manipulations. And we all have to pay a price for this, right? We all have to give and take. Nobody is coming out at the top. And nobody can have only benefits from this or expect only benefits. We're all asked or actually forced to make tremendous sacrifices. But why? Because the ultimate goal is fantastic. There's going to be a world united, a world where, there are no boundaries, a world where, our children can pick up their bags and go and work and live anywhere on Earth, a world where the resources of the Earth are distributed relatively equally, where there is no conflict between nations because there are no nations, where every kind of interaction, every kind of problem is solved peacefully through dialogue and not through the use of military force. So all of these goals, the ultimate goal is fantastic. But we have to abandon our old loyalties, loyalty to country, to nation, to race, to religion, and so on. We have to transcend these old loyalties, and we have to expand our horizons to embrace, this greater world that has such diversity. And we're the first generation to be asked to do that, which requires tremendous understanding, if you want, and a tremendous sort of personal evolution.
Indeed. Okay, Kevin Galilee, ladies and gentlemen, you can Google him and you can find his books. What was the name of your books again, sorry?
My last book is called Killing Us Softly: Causes and Consequences of the Global Depopulation Policy. And my next book, which is probably going to be finished in about 3 or 4 months, will be called Survival or Extinction. And I think this will be the most important work I will have done in my life, in addition to my own principles. The own principles I've already published 2 years ago. And as I said, now they are the stated policy of the Civil Rights Party of Canada. So they're going to find a practical application, hopefully, in the near future here within Canada as part of our political system.
All right. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. And lastly, just to reiterate, this is a 100% listener-supported broadcast. So if you would go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and subscribe and donate regularly, because I will be bringing on guests regularly who will enlighten you, who will help you, who will advance humanity down a better path. If you support me, you support all of them by proxy. how much do you value the future of humanity? Is it $5 a month? Hopefully, at least that. We'll see you again sometime, folks. Thank you very much.
You are the only exception. You